Troy. Welcome to WRAF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone-in talk show with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan. Peter and Julene will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julene.
Hey, thank you very much. Welcome. Hi, Julene.
Hi, Peter.
Well, we're just bursting with pride, aren't we?
We are.
Yeah, we got another award. When we say this is the Night Call, the WRIF's award-winning Night Call show, we got another award from the Metro Times.
Thank you,
guys.
Metro Times, yeah. For recognizing us.
Yeah, yeah. Here we are,
pretty
tucked
cool.
Away on a Sunday night and still.
Yes.
Yeah. This is, we've said this, one of the things they recognized us for was this is the longest running talk show in American radio history.
It's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wow.
And you say, well, wait a minute. How could that be? What about, well, this has been going on. It was launched in 1970, so that's almost 43 years ago. Actually, it was in May of 1970.
Yeah.
So, and a few hosts. I've hosted it for good portion of the time, to be sure. We only do it weekly, so we don't get the big props.
Yeah, well, you know
what?
That's
okay. We're not in it for the props.
We're not. We're in it to make
change.
For the
money. No, for change.
Change.
That's what we make. Change. You know, I don't know if we should go so far with this, but, you know, I'm always surprised at that everybody, not everybody, but lots of people make the assumption that we are just these multimillionaires.
We're rolling in it.
We're rolling in it. Yeah, we're rolling in something.
Hey, we're rolling in pride.
We are. We are. Hey, this is a phone-in talk show, so you can reach us at 313-298-WRIF, which is?
It's 313-298-9743.
A lot going on our Facebook page, so we'd like you to join us. Just give us a like. Give us a look and give us a like. Hey, facebook.com/nightcall. And John Miller, our producer, will have our podcast available at noon on Monday.
Yes.
And thank you to Jeremy Campbell, who actually puts it up there.
He does.
Right.
Another person who's been at this radio station for a long time.
Has
Jeremy,
he?
Yeah.
Has he? Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Not
lot,
as long as you, Peter.
No.
You win the award.
I do. A lot going on this week. 10th anniversary of the Iraq War. The Supreme Court of the United States of America is going to start hearing these marriage equality bills. The DOMA bill, which is the Defense of Marriage Act, and also Proposition 8, which was a California law or constitutional amendment, I think, that outlawed same-sex marriage in California. Also,
well, this should be interesting.
Yeah.
An interesting week in this.
Well, it is. I wonder, these constitutionalists, they could go either way.
Yeah.
The equal protection under the law. How about that? You know, that's always.
Yeah, that little thing.
And if you can't get married, you miss out on there's about 1,000, not that you could get them all, but there's 1,000 benefits that
right.
You're denied if you cannot marry.
Including some real, I mean, they're all serious, yeah. But when you can't visit your partner in the hospital when they're dying, there's a lot of issues with property and things like
sure.
That. I mean, people just need to get over it. And, you know, I feel change has been coming for a long time in this country, and the fact that there are states that have legal marriage, including the one I was born in, Iowa, which that's just, I can't believe that. Iowa. And so change is in the wind, but let's see. We'll see what the Supreme Court has to say.
Well, even if it doesn't, if you think about some of the setbacks that women have had and minorities, and I mean, eventually, I mean, because the thrust of it all is the American Revolution, the Democratic Revolution that spread rights to everybody. That's what it was all about.
Amazing. Rights for everybody.
Yeah.
I mean, how can that even be thought of as a crazy idea?
Yeah.
I'll never get that.
And the conservatives have fought every inch of the way to stop democratic rights from being expanded.
Those conservatives. And in our Metro Times award, it did say that that you drive right-wing Republicans bonkers, was the word. And
bonkers,
they said which is cool.
Yeah.
But the thing is I'm right in there with you.
You are. They mention you. They talk about you,
yeah.
Too. Well, here is the good news. When you start doing the statistics on support for marriage equality, and you know the higher up the demographics you get, the worse people are in terms of fairness and equality and what have you. But among 18 to 29-year-olds, 81% percent of people in that age bracket support marriage equality.
That's huge.
And a lot of, and that includes a lot of you listening. So I don't know. Maybe this is a closed subject. Like, yeah, if gays want to get married, so what? You know, actually, well, the other things we want to talk about, of course, tomorrow, Detroit's emergency financial manager, Kenneth Orr, Kevin Orr, isn't it? Yeah, Kevin Orr, will arrive in Detroit from the Jones Day law firm, which is a whole, they have 2,400 lawyers.
What?
Yeah, it's an enormous firm.
Damn.
And he was the vice president for diversity, and it was like him. He was the diverse. Everybody else almost in the whole joint is white. I mean, but it's worse than that. I mean, in fact, you know, Kevin Orr had these tax liens that he hadn't paid and all that. But we'll talk about that. And then guns.
Oh my gosh! You're bringing up the G word again.
Yeah, the G word. But we'll talk about that. Yeah, guys, I don't know what
the guns. They're like, I can't wait. Go ahead.
Right, but let's stay a little on gay marriage. Yeah, you know, we've sent this out before, and I was reading Frank Bruni, I think, in the New York Times weekend section, and he was saying, I mean, we mentioned guns, and one of the things that people that are, I don't know what you would, it's because it's not pro-guns and anti-guns. That's a weird formulation. But the people that want the least restriction on guns, they can make an argument. They say if guns are limited or restricted or confiscated, here are the consequences which will occur, and they will be negative. They will be negative for me, and they'll be negative for the country. I mean, so they have an argument, right?
Many arguments.
Many arguments, okay. And then you have abortion. And then you have the people that...
Like pro-life. Like, we're anti-life because we're pro-choice.
Don't even use it.
You know what I mean? It's just the most ridiculous term ever.
They own it.
They do.
But I mean, when we call them the compulsory pregnancy movement, that doesn't resonate. They just, it's like I'm trying to be,
I don't know.
Yeah, something.
But wait a minute.
Now for once.
What that means, Peter.
You're always trying to bring me back on track. Now you're getting me off track. All right. So the gun people, I don't want to call them that. I mean, the people that, let's call them the gun people. The gun people have arguments on their side that there could be consequences, negative consequences, if the, let's call them the anti-gun people, or the no-guns people, if the no-gun people got their way. All right? The anti-abortion people, the compulsory pregnancy people, they identify a fetus as having the qualities of a child, even though it's not capable of living on its own, even to the point where in North Dakota, they virtually have banned abortion, violating the dictates of the Supreme Court, that they say that, and let's not go into the details, because I want to make my point.
Okay. But,
so here they say, here are some negative consequences. Women have an abortion, here's what we think has happened, and it's negative. What is it with marriage equality? What is the negative?
There are a lot of people still are just plain damn homophobic, Peter. It's the way it is.
Well, they can't make an argument saying, I don't like them. You ever think about what they do?
I don't want to think
about
it.
Don't you love it? Love it. No, I hate it. No, I'm talking about with the women. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
Well,
I like
fine, but the guys, that's just gross, you know.
Right.
And I've heard people, recently I heard someone say, I overheard a conversation, well, I don't, you know, they can get married, but I just don't think they should have kids. I'm thinking, I just think it's plain ignorance. I'm sorry, but I do.
Let's go into this a little. There was an article in the New York Times that's way pro-gay marriage and marriage equality, and here's the way it began. Here are their causes lost. The demographics in the march of history have doomed their campaign to keep marriage only between a man and a woman. But the young conservatives who oppose same-sex marriage, they're in the 19%. 81% of people between 18 and 29 support marriage equality. The young conservatives who oppose same-sex marriage, unlike most of their generation, remain undaunted. They're going right ahead. They identify themselves as part of the pro-marriage movement.
Really?
Wait a minute.
That's not pro-marriage.
Hey, wait a minute. Here's a whole bunch of people that want to get married, and they don't want them to get married.
Yeah, that's anti-marriage.
You know, one of the things that, one of the, you know, there's different perceptions of gay men and gay women. And
totally.
And what one of the qualities that was always attributed to gay men is their promiscuity. which I couldn't care less about people's sex life as long as they're happy. But one of the things,
and being safe is pretty good idea.
But one of the things that happened, being pariahs, being outcasts, that very frequently the only way that a gay man who was like hiding it could have fulfill his sexual desires would be to go to a bathhouse or even worse to a rest stop or something like that.
Airport bathroom.
Oh yeah, like if you're a U.S. senator. Remember Senator Weidstein?
Yeah.
What was his name?
He was doing a little toe tap. Larry Craig.
Larry Craig. Yeah. The senator for Idaho, which also was a self-identification.
And then what?
Idaho.
Idaho. And, yeah. And he didn't he resign?
I can't remember.
No, I think he got defeated. I think he stood tough.
He stood there with his wife. I remember. I'm just looking at the wife thinking.
Well, that poor woman, she's
well, let's get back to this. So here are these young conservatives. They're in the 19% of the people between 18 and 29. And I don't mind that. I mean, I've been in, like, minorities of, like, 3% on some issues.
Yeah.
So, but you know, we're moving along here. They see themselves at the beginning of a long political struggle, much like the battle over abortion. In other words, these freaks want to keep this going for the next half a century.
Yes, they do.
If they can begin shifting the terms of the debate away from gay rights and towards the meaning of marriage, they say they have a chance to survive long-term defeats. Now, here is what Joseph Blackholm, 34, he's the executive director of something called the Family Policy Institute of Washington.
Mm-hmm.
He says the primary challenge that our side faces right now is the intense social pressure. To the extent that the other side is able to frame this as a vote for gay people to be happy, it will be challenging for us.
My God. Wow.
What do these people realize what they're saying? Yeah. All is about this section of humanity and of our fellow citizens and our kids and our neighbors and our brothers and sisters.
Yeah.
They want to be happy. We can't allow that.
You will not be happy.
You will not be happy.
We're going to make sure of it.
What is with these people?
Oh, no. I know. It's awful.
And one of the things that I think about what is wrong with this country, the economy, the environment, the infrastructure, crime, the maldistribution of wealth and income, the health care, everything like that. And I got, let's get a cause. I got an idea. Let's stop people from marrying. What's wrong with people marrying? No, people of the same sex. Oh, yeah. Let's stop that. Why? Well, it's not traditional.
I mean, really.
You know what was tradition?
Living in a box is sad. That's sad.
You know what was tradition?
What?
White-only drinking fountains.
There you go.
You know
right
what?
There, Peter.
You know what was tradition? You're a woman, you can't vote.
That's right.
Yeah, right.
Uh-huh.
And on and on and on.
That was a big tradition.
That's a big tradition.
Yeah.
Now, the high-profile effort, this group called the National Organization for Marriage. And this is, hey, join us if you'd like this conversation. At least like to be part of it. 313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
And here, I would like to hear from someone who thinks there should not be marriage equality and can tell us where the harm lies. In other words, if I said, tell me where the harm lies in abortion, boom, boom, boom. People could say what it is. If someone said, what if we confiscated all the guns? What would the harm be? Boom, 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 boom. People would have exactly things to say.
Mm-hmm.
But when we've put this out there so many times, a couple people have called in and said it's about kids. But let me address that in a second. Don't do a kid thing on me. Just about how would marriage equality affect me as a longtime married heterosexual? Okay, tell me about that. Which I don't think this is a good way to get calls because I think it's daunting. Just like they're undaunted.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's why it is daunting.
That's okay.
So there's going to be this big
march. Don't be shy.
There's going to be a big march on the National Mall in Washington on Tuesday, the day the Supreme Court is scheduled to hear arguments on this voter-approved ban on same-sex marriage in California. Now here, I thought, okay, they're going to tell us. The Heritage Foundation released a report in defense of traditional marriage. I don't get that.
Oh, them.
I don't get that, though, because nobody's attacking traditional marriage.
They just want to get married as well.
As in a traditional manner.
And Yes, there are, some of these are quite traditional and formal weddings.
And we know, and I think we've mentioned this before, that there are people called radical fairies that have appropriated the name that was usually used as a slur, fairies,
right.
Like queer. And what they've done is to say they're fairies. They're radical fairies, and they denounce marriage as being, they said they don't want to be part of straight culture.
Right.
They think that gay life, as it's constituted the way they consider it, to be something separate and distinct and something they want to maintain. And they do not want to be integrated into heterosexual society.
Yeah.
But they're this teeny minority. But anyway,
very, very teeny.
Marriage, what it is, why it matters, and the consequences of redefining it. So I'm going, okay, now, but then it doesn't really, it doesn't tell what it is right away. But here, it says the fight is shaping up to be a difficult one for these conservatives, with public opinion increasingly seeming to shift in favor of same-sex marriage. More than 100 high-profile Republicans recently filed a brief urging the Supreme Court to declare that gay couples have a constitutional right. Constitutional right, it's called. To marry, because equal protection under the laws. And Senator Rob Portman of Ohio, the only sitting Republican senator to support same-sex marriage because his son is gay. And, you know, it's interesting. People say, oh, he's just being an opportunist. He's only because it affects him. Well, hello.
Maybe,
he's defending his son.
Yeah, he loves his son.
A majority of Americans support same-sex marriage, with even young Republicans moving in that direction. They're not there yet. 45% of Republicans between 18 and 44 said that they thought same-sex couples should be able to marry. A contrast with Republicans 45 and older, only 20% of them agree.
Wow. My God.
That's, I'll be so glad when they're gone.
I know. That's so horrifying.
That's hard. That's nasty to say.
Well, I just wish they would just...
All right, here.
Come to their senses.
You get into this article in the New York Times again, talking about these conservative, young conservatives, the 19% of this group, 18 to
29.
81% of who support marriage equality, they're the 19%. So here's why the marriage equality is bad, apparently. In redefining marriage to include same-sex couples, what you're doing is you're excluding the norm of sexual I knew I couldn't do it.
You can do it.
Yeah. What you're doing is you're excluding the norm of sexual complementarity.
Huh?
That's what I said. That's why there shouldn't be same-sex marriage, folks, because they're excluding the norm of sexual complementarity.
That's the most ridiculous and confusing thing
we don't even know if it's ridiculous because we don't know what it is.
It's confusing. Yeah.
And I got to say, if you don't know what it is and it doesn't go, oh, yeah, well, that's right. You know, I understand. Then he says, once you exclude that norm, whatever it is, three other norms, which are monogamy, sexual exclusivity, and permanency, become optional as well. Well, because heterosexuals, as we all know, are always monogamous, are always sexually exclusive, and have permanent relationships.
Hello.
Jolene?
What? What? What are you talking about?
Nothing.
I'm a good girl.
You are, but you've been married a couple times.
Yes, I have.
Yeah. All right. The result proponents of traditional marriage say would be further rises in divorce rates and out-of-wedlock births. Well, actually,
I might do it again. There you go, Peter.
Those heterosexuals, they're the ones with the divorce rates because gays aren't married. And out-of-wedlock births are actually dropping considerably. So that's not an issue. So somebody else, a director of programs for the Love and Fidelity Network, when you de-link marriage from childbearing, you then have to increase the complexity of that relationship.
Huh?
And I understand these people. My wife and I never had any kids.
That's right.
We were with, a good number of our friends don't have any kids. I don't know. Mm-hmm. So increase the complexity of that relationship? Cool. I don't know. Proponents of same-sex marriage respond, there is no evidence link it to social ills, and that, in fact, divorce rates are even lower in states that are more accepting of gay marriage.
Huh. Well, isn't that interesting?
So...
You know, and I know so many very loyal, monogamous, long-time gay and lesbian couples, and so...
I know some pretty wild gays, too.
Well,
and I know some pretty wild heterosexuals. I know some pretty wild heterosexuals, too.
Yeah, you're sitting across from one.
Yeah.
Go ahead. Just keep going.
Okay. They say same-sex marriage fits with the country's long history of extending equal rights to groups once denied them. That's equal protection. And here, Thomas Peters, the communications director for the National Organization for Marriage. Most young people think if you come out with traditional marriage views, you're a bigot.
Well, okay, you kind of are.
Yeah, all right. Okay, well, I thought there was something.
So that's Tuesday.
That's they're going to be talking about. Well, here is the, here, you remember, there, that's one of the things to say. What about, the kids? You got these gay guys raising kids, and you know what that could mean? No. What? No. Yeah. The American Academy.
It's disgusting that they even think that.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. The American Academy of Pediatrics, this prestigious medical group that deals with medicine for kids, declared its support for same-sex marriage for the first time on Thursday. So what do you think about that, Mr. Homophobe?
Pediatrics.
Yeah.
Doctors of children.
Get this, saying that allowing gay and lesbian parents to marry if they so choose is in the best interests of their children.
For the kids, see?
The Academy's new policy statement says same-sex marriage helps guarantee rights, benefits, and long-term security for children. So they're all for it.
I thought that was great. I was happy to read that. And like I said, things are changing and...
Maybe this is a done deal. We don't have to talk about
it. I don't know about that.
Yeah. Well, they did all these studies with 39 families with lesbian mothers, 74 heterosexual parents, and 60 families headed by single heterosexual women. You know who did the worst, unfortunately, were the single heterosexual women. I mean, that's a tough road.
Yes.
That's a way tough road.
Yeah, absolutely. And,
it's not to say that they're not good parents and good people and don't raise great kids.
They're just stretched thin.
They're stretched thin, and sometimes things go wrong. Colorado has approved same-sex unions as well.
Yeah,
all right, let's get Eric on the air here because we want some responses. 313-298-WRIF. Hey, Eric. Hi. You're on the air. Welcome.
It's great to be here.
Thank you. Welcome. What's up?
Well, I'm just driving home and listening to you guys, and I'm just fuming just with all the, I don't want to say bigotry because, I have friends that don't necessarily like when I bring up the fact that I'm gay, but they know. But it's not something that I feel I should hide anymore. Growing up in society, and I just think I should be able to get married. If I grow up and I've been falling in love with guys since, you know, like 16, 17, after you hit puberty and, you know, biologically you start looking for a quote-unquote mate, why can't the government recognize that?
Well, because because it's steeped in long-term prejudices, like the other things that we said. I don't, think about slavery. You know, how long that took? Think about
exactly, and that was a comment when you said that too. I was like, ooh, that sounds like a Facebook status or something to me.
Oh, everything can be a Facebook status.
Yeah.
Right?
But here, Jalene and I have something in unison to say to your friends.
What?
Right.
Oh, here's what we have to say to your friends.
Get over it.
Yes, get over it.
Yeah.
Just get over it.
We're just people.
Yeah.
We just fall in love just like everybody else.
You're right.
The only thing that I'm fearful about, Eric, is that there is something in people that when they can't deal with the real source of their frustration and anger, they look for a scapegoat. And that often happens in confusing times and in times of economic deprivation and what have you. So I don't know. I mean, you know, there's so many people that the haters in the country hate. You don't know really where it's all going to...
what it's stemming from, too.
Well, or what it's stemming from, but their anger at other people that are on the same level as them just makes things worse and doesn't allow us any problem solving.
It adds to all the turmoil of what else we got going on in the world. Why can't, you know, on top of everything else, gay people can't get married, you know, like that's a big issue.
Yeah.
I just think it's crazy that this is still something that, not to say that I'm, you know, saying why are we talking about it, but that we even are having this conversation right now.
That we have to have it.
But the other thing that I've said, and we've been doing this now for years, maybe since 2006 when Clinton, signed, Bill Clinton signed that awful bill that was generated by the Republicans, the Defense of Marriage Act. But I mean, that's no excuse that he signed it. That, I mean, what a hypocrite to sign the Defense of Marriage Act, Bill Clinton. What a joke.
That's a good
And all
good
those Republicans
right
that were trying to, impeach him at the time, they all were, you know, doing their ladies behind their wives'
they
back.
They call him a side piece.
The side, little side piece, and all that. But since then, so this is like 7 years, I've been saying to people, tell me the one thing, how marriage equality is going to hurt traditional marriage. Once in a while, they come up with this stupid thing about kids, but that's not about, that doesn't hurt traditional marriage. You could maybe, you know, well, I mean, I guess you can't make it too well since, this American Pediatric Society said it doesn't hold any water, but that doesn't do it. They say that somehow my heterosexual marriage is going to be hurt by a man marrying a man or a woman marrying a woman. And as we've also said, I don't know how much you've heard the show, but when there's been scenes in California and Washington, D.C. and Iowa, everywhere, where here are these people that have been essentially said they're not fully a human being or fully a citizen, come bursting out of a church or a justice of the peace office, kissing one another, saying how happy they are, talking about love. And then you look across the street, and there are these people saying,
The protesters. The Westboro Church.
Yeah. What did the Beatles say? All you need is love. Tell it to those
That's
bigots.
Right, baby.
Yeah. All right, thank you very much.
Thanks, Eric.
Bye now.
Stand tough, my friend.
Absolutely.
We're behind you.
Let's see. Here is Leah. Leah is in Algonac. Hey, Leah, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you guys doing?
We're good. What's
Hi,
up?
Leah.
Oh, that's great. I needed to make something clear, and I don't know if I'm all alone on saying this. I'll be 47. I don't know if it's just the way I was grown up or the generation I grew up in, but I never understood gayness, you know what I mean? I was raised with, you know, Adam and Eve, not Adam and Steve, blah, blah.
So you and haven't been around it. You haven't really been exposed. Is that correct?
Well, right. And I worked alongside with a young man, and he was gay. And until he explained things to me, I had an attitude with it all prior to. I just knew that it wasn't accepted. And for me to judge that, I wasn't right
Aww.
For doing that.
I love that guy got a hold of you.
But you know what? Well, I have to say, Leah, I don't, and as you said, I don't really understand gay. You know, you got to really be gay to understand gay.
That's nothing to understand.
Well, you don't understand it, like, deeply, or, you know.
But why should you?
That's what I was going to say. I mean, why do we have to, understand it or not? What we're talking about, essentially, is how do we all meet in what they call the public square? And do we all have equal rights? And are we all accepted? And, you know, the thing is, like, with a lot of this stuff, if you don't like it, one shouldn't do it then, right? Or if you're not attracted to something, one shouldn't. But people shouldn't be punished because the majority holds some view, that is wrong. And now what we're learning, of course, is that among the younger generation, they vastly say, I don't even know if it's support. It's probably like, who cares?
Yeah,
right.
It really is.
All right, let me ask you this.
No, I understand that 100%. I was raising kids. My oldest is 27. And now, you know, they're openly in the public holding hands and this and that. I have to explain this to my kids. I'm saying it's okay.
Wait a minute. You got to explain to a 27-year-old why two guys are holding hands.
I'm sorry. I misconstrued that. When they were younger, I had to explain to them, you know, why there are two men holding hands.
Yeah. Well, it probably wasn't too hard,
and expressing affection out in public. And at that time, that was accepted, not in my era.
Well, in your era, there was a guy singing The Times They Are Changing, right, Bob Dylan?
Absolutely. Well, there was a lot of those in my time, but...
Well, all right, Leah, thank you.
That's a good story.
You're the
I like
best.
The whole thing, Leah.
Yes, indeed. Bye-bye.
Rock on, sister.
Yeah. Right, because one of the things is that... a lot of people can't alter the feelings they have, although they ought to try. But the other thing they shouldn't be.
Sometimes it does take someone close to you
and
to expose you to things.
And the other thing is, you just kind of step back, right? Don't get in other people's way.
Worry about your own stuff, because everyone has a lot.
Yeah, that's right. Here is Maddie. Maddie's in Canton. Hey, Maddie. Hi, you're on the air.
Hey, how you guys doing?
We're good. What's up?
Well, let's hear. It's personal on my part, but as I was growing up, I knew I wasn't, like, one of the guys. I knew I wasn't, you know, wasn't fit for that. I knew something was different about me. And so, like, when I did research and stuff like that, when you try doing research on something that's, you know, it's myself who is transgender, when you go online, you find nothing but, you know, horrible or, you know, pornographic material, and that's not what I want to look at. I want to identify myself with something, but I'm not male, and I'm female. So it's like, so when I grew up and I finally had the courage to come out to my parents, they were all against it. They are, even today, they still don't agree with it. But I mean, like when I came out to them, oh, it's wrong, don't do it, just stop doing it and you'll be fine. Well, that's not the case. That's not how it works. And it's just the fact that, you know, me, as I now identify myself as, a girl and who is pansexual, my therapist even told me I'm on another level of love. I can accept someone regardless of their genitalia or their gender mindset. And it's just the fact that, like, people who don't understand or anything like that, it's like, then why even bother putting them a fight against it? Why is it so hard just to accept it and just let it go? Change needs to happen. It's going to happen regardless.
Accept people as they are. I suggest, I don't know where is he from?
Can't.
I mean, I'm sorry. I think you should move to Ferndale.
Yeah.
Come on over.
I think she should stay in Canton and make people be real.
Make change?
Make people be real. Sometimes it's hard, though. But, yeah, I mean, as I was saying earlier, Maddie, most societies need somebody that they can say, you know, that's the other. And they act as a focal point for their anger, their frustration, and what have you. Hopefully, we'll get to a point where we celebrate each other's differences.
I mean, that's how you and I are.
Yeah.
And I have many transgender friends. I do. And I never even blinked an eye. It's like, hey, you know, we got along. You're my friend. I'm your friend. I love you. I accept you. I just don't understand this lack of acceptance that, you know, people are who they want to be. And if that's who you are, hey, you know, you go with it.
Thank you, Maddie. Appreciate your call. Then, you know, we are saying do this, do that. It must be so tough.
Okay, yeah.
Even in with attitudes changing about gayness, it still must be
still tough.
Still tough.
Yes, absolutely.
Sure. Even in Ferndale.
Well, I don't know. Ferndale's pretty laid back. Okay. I did a live broadcast at Rosie O'Grady's in Ferndale last week for St. Patty's Day. We're pretty open over there.
All right, we're going to take a break. I want to talk about maybe people won't come back. We'll talk about the economy
a
little.
Don't say that. we're going to talk about guns, too.
Yeah. Speaking about making it real, something real is going to happen tomorrow here in the city of Detroit, so we're going to talk about that. But, hey, if you're ready for old-time hockey, and I'm talking about old-time here, the Detroit Red Wing alumni will be playing a charity hockey game to benefit the United Cerebral Palsy of Detroit. It's going to be Saturday, March 30th, and so that's this coming Saturday at the Viking Arena in Hazel Park. Doors open at 3:30. There'll be a silent auction and a pizza afterglow, and you can meet and greet some of the former Wings. That's a good deal. They're going to be playing the UCP Pucksters, or is it the United Cerebral Palsy of Detroit? The UCP Pucksters.
Cool.
Aren't they going to get their ass kicked? They're going to be playing Red Wings alumni. Shouldn't I say that word?
No, you can say that word.
Oh, okay.
I don't know what you mean.
There's going to be a hockey game. There's going to be a charity.
You're understanding what this is.
Yeah, I do. There's a charity hockey game.
Okay.
You don't understand what it is.
All right. And I didn't read the flyer.
And it's the UCP Pucksters versus the Red Wings alumni.
Okay.
So it's going to be a game.
Maybe the alumni will.
Tickets are just $10, $25 for family up to five members. Kids five and under are free, and you can go to skatewithoutlimits.org. Skatewithoutlimits.org.
Okay.
Yeah, it's going to be a good thing. All right, so we'll be back and talk about this Detroit financial manager, what that's going to mean for the city of Detroit and for us around the city.
Yikes.
And also, guns.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jalene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Jalene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
My mum always says hard work never hurt anybody. Good advice as usual. So we worked very hard to make Geico.com very easy. Say you want to report a claim and follow its progress. You can do it all online at Geico.com. Not to mention perhaps saving a tidy sum of money on your car insurance. All it takes is a few clicks. So visit Geico.com today. Oh, and mum, if you're listening, yes, I did wash behind my ears this morning.
Hey, babe. I know you're the chameleon with the great eye, so I wanted to talk about the color we painted the living room.
Oh, that new Cosmic Berry? It's great.
Yeah, it's good. But Valspar has the Love Your Color guarantee, so if we don't love it, we get another color free.
We do love it, so no need to change.
Are we certain we love it?
We love it. We didn't love having your mother stay with us for a month.
We didn't have a choice.
We are chameleons. We always have a choice.
Offer ends 10-7-13. See loveyourcolor.com for offer terms.
How do you keep an older car running like new? Just ask a Ford customer.
Jackie, tell me why somebody should bring their car here to the Ford dealership for service instead of those other places.
They have wonderful service. I come and make sure I get my oil changed, and when they tell you your tires need to be rotated, you got to get that done as well.
The Works, $39.95 or less, minus a $10 mail-in rebate. That's $29.95. Click on the banner ad now. Up to 5 quarts oil, taxes, diesel, disposal fees extra. Rebate by check. See participating Ford dealer for exclusions and rebate details with 33113.
As your HR rep, it's my duty to alert everyone to the newest pandemic spreading across our nation called desk dining. It's caused by repeatedly eating lunch at one's desk. Its symptoms include a rotten attitude and constant blank staring out of the window. My official recommendation is to start eating lunch at Buffalo Wild Wings, the cure-all to lameness caused by desk dining. Except for you, Phil. You'd be lame no matter where you ate.
With tons of big screens and more delicious menu items for less cash, we're the perfect place for lunch. Buffalo Wild Wings. Wings, beer, sports.
Hey, what's on your bucket list? Skydiving? Running with the bulls? Backing up your computer files? Yeah, you can forget that one. Get Carbonite Online Backup, and your files will be backed up to the cloud automatically. Unlimited backup space is just $59 a year, and you can access your backed up files anytime, anywhere with a free app. Try it free at Carbonite.com. No credit card required. Use offer code PROTECT and get 2 bonus months with purchase. Carbonite.com. Offer code PROTECT.
It starts with one thing.
I don't know why. It doesn't even matter how hard you try. Keep that in mind. I designed this rhyme to explain in due time.
All I know.
Time is a valuable thing. Watch it fly by as the pendulum swings. Watch it count down to the end of the day. The clock ticks life away. It's so unreal. You didn't look out below. Watch the time go right out the window. Trying to hold on to didn't even know. I wasted it all just to watch you go. I didn't even know I tried. It all fell apart. What it meant to me will eventually be a memory of a time I tried so hard and got so far. But in the end, it doesn't even matter. I had to fall to lose it all. But in the end, it doesn't even matter. One thing, I don't know why. It doesn't even matter how hard you try. Keep that in mind, I designed this rhyme to remind myself how I tried so hard. In spite of the way you were mocking me, acting like I was part of your property. Remembering all the times you fought with me, I'm surprised it got so. Things aren't the way they were before. You wouldn't even recognize me anymore. Not that you knew me back then, but it all comes back to me in the end. You kept everything inside, and even though I tried, it all fell apart. What it meant to me will eventually be a memory. Tried so hard and got so far, but in the end, it doesn't even matter. I had to
This. This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Voice your opinion at 313-298-WRIF. That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter Werby and Julene Jordan.
Thank you very much, Ann. Welcome back. We were talking about the gay marriage court hearings that are going to occur this coming week.
Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court. The Supremes are going to be examining this Proposition 8, which abolished gay marriage in California, and also the so-called Defense of Marriage Act, except we don't understand how it defends marriage. It limits the number of people that can be married. But whatever. So mostly we were getting testimonials from people. In fact, it was only 50 minutes ago, but at least two of the people were, gay?
Yeah.
Or was it all? No, then, and then the woman, Leah, who said that she didn't understand gay, but then she grew up and understood.
Mm-hmm.
You got to live and let live. All right. Let's just talk. And I forgot, too, this is the 10th anniversary of Bush's horrid war that just has wreaked so much damage on Iraq and on this country. So many people dead, wounded, driven from their homes. And now Iraq, this country that we set free from this dictator,
right,
now is an ally of Iran and is letting shipments of arms go over and through, in Iraqi airspace and actually through the roads of Iraq to deliver weapons to President Assad of Syria.
Yeah.
Which is making sure that that conflict goes on.
I mean, that whole war did nothing. It did zero. All it did was cause death and destruction. And
part of the ruination of our economy.
Oh, but what it did do was it made a whole lot of people really rich.
Yeah, right. Well, that's what I don't understand. You know,
it's disgusting.
I was actually surprised. I think we talked about that last week. They said that the approval rating for Hugo Chavez, the late president of Venezuela, was around 8%. But then when you look at the approval rating of George Bush or Dick Cheney, it's in the 40s. You got all these Republicans that think he's just great. And Hugo Chavez, I've got 10 criticisms of him, if you'd like. Probably none of the ones that you folks have. But when I was in Caracas, I was in a protest demonstration against Chavez.
Yeah.
With these native people who were complaining that their land was going to be confiscated and destroyed for this industrial infrastructure that Chavez wanted to put together to get more oil wealth, which he used for good things. I mean, that Venezuela actually had the greatest reduction of poverty of any country in the world over the last 10 or 15 years during Chavez.
Due to that, yeah.
Yeah. But anyway.
People don't know that. They just focus on, everything else.
Well, okay. Let's do, we probably would do better with the, with this war and what it left us with. But maybe we should just talk about the economy. You know, the economists, do you ever pay any attention to your economics classes? Man, that was the biggest snore, and who cares?
Oh, God.
The only thing
it was
torture. What did you remember was supply and demand.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah. when the demand is greater than the supply, the price goes up.
That was
an
awful college experience.
But they also have macroeconomics and microeconomics.
Okay, of course.
So, like macro, in this case, what do I know? But we could talk about macro as being the whole world economy, the globalized capitalist economy. The micro economy could be anywhere from as large as, say, Detroit, down to our own individual finances. We're the micro, right?
Yeah.
But everything. Here you have this world that is awash in wealth. Trillions and trillions and trillions of dollars in wealth is owned by a very, very small percentage of the world's population, to the point where that when I put my income into this generator that tells you in
what percentile
you are. I mean, I'm in the 1%. I mean, so is Jolene. So are you, probably everybody listening. So
did you say the 1%?
Yeah. I'm in the 1% of the world.
Of the world.
Well, of the world.
Because there's so much poverty.
Yeah, exactly.
Be real.
Yet, there's enough wealth in the entire world that sequestered, if you will, in the hands of just a few men, a couple women, or so. And so all the travail, all the misery, all these wars and everything that are often just squabbles for trying to get a larger share of a little, could all be alleviated if these people were only rich instead of horribly, filthy, obscenely rich. So you didn't have people that were these, like, multi-billionaires, right? I mean, I was just talking to somebody. Who was I talking to today? I was saying if you take the Walton family, the people that own Walmarts, their net worth is about $110 billion, right?
Right, yeah.
So if you confiscated $100 billion for them, they would be left, each of them, with $2 billion.
That's still a whole lot.
Yeah. I mean, it's an impossible sum for anyone to deal with, no matter, like, Alice Walton starts this big art museum down in Arkansas with all this great art that's worth hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And if you do a rounding off to the big number, she's still worth, $40 billion or something like that.
Hey, you know that movie, miniseries called The Bible? That has been airing. Did you see where they made Obama look like, or the devil look like Obama and that whole thing? That thing is so creepy. Anyway, it's surprisingly, someone told me, sponsored by Walmart.
Oh, come on.
Yeah.
Well, someone was saying.
That just makes sense.
Someone was saying that in, what's that one, sort of set in a medieval time? Game of Thrones.
Yeah.
That they had one time they had a head on a pike and it was like Bush's head.
Really?
Yeah.
Wait, I think I remember you telling me that. Yeah.
Anyway, so I don't know if you've been catching this stuff that's been going on in Cyprus, this fairly large island in the middle of the Mediterranean, where everybody's in the news. They all seem to speak perfect English. I don't quite get it, but they do. And I was trying to, I was trying to go through all this stuff. Mood darkens in Cyprus's deadline is set for bailout. Now, there's a collapse of these banks in Cyprus. And I mean, wait a minute, going, whoa, man, I really want to get out of here if this guy's going to start talking about banks in Cyprus. But this is all interconnected.
It's all tied.
And the question is, in a wealthy, wealthy world, why are the banks in Cyprus collapsing? Why are cities in the United States, like our own city of Detroit,
Greece.
Look what's happening in Greece, everywhere. And on the other hand, we know that there's all this incredible wealth floating around. There's a lot of mismanagement, and it's not the people that are always asked to pay for it. It's not the people that live in Nicosia, the capital of Cyprus. It's not the people that live in Detroit that caused the problem.
Yeah.
They mostly were just working their butts off, trying to do their job and keep alive and enjoy life. As much as possible. I mean, things were fraying for a long time, to be sure, in Detroit. But some of these countries in Europe where the rug was just pulled out from under them, and that's an interesting concept. Who in the world pulled the rug out from under them? I mean, or what happened? Why was like Ireland this incredibly dynamic economy? And then, I mean, a lot of it had to do with the overvaluation of like real estate and what have it, the so-called housing bubble, which was international. But it Cyprus bailout incites turmoil as blame flies. What's going on here? I mean, what's going on in the world, and why, if there's, like I say, there's so much incredible wealth in the world, why are so many things screwed up? I mean, really? I mean, and people sometimes, they say, well, the unions wanted too much money. I mean, come on. Do you think the unions screwed up the world economy or even Detroit? I mean, that's nonsense. One thing that's nonsense as well, President Obama had an advantage over the Republicans on who could best handle the economy, and now...
That's gone.
Obama's standing has declined by roughly 10 percentage points, while the Republicans in Congress have gained 4 to 5%. They say roughly an equal number of Americans favor Obama as favor congressional Republicans on economic matters. I just don't even know what to say.
I don't either.
I mean, about either of them.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's just, it's absolutely ridiculous. And with this deal, you've heard this, or many of you know about it, the sequestering, where there's these huge cuts. So now they're doing things. We had a caller last week They're closing down 3 air traffic control towers in Michigan. Yeah. Oh, that's nice.
The caller last week was an air traffic controller.
At Detroit City Airport, which has lost it, as he said, at the Coleman A. Young International Airport in Detroit. We're coming in.
Oh.
We're coming in.
You're on your own.
Yeah, are we clear? Oh, well.
I guess we're clear.
Yeah, I guess we're clear. Yeah. So, here's another thing that I think speaks to all this. The American Society of Civil Engineers. You know, these are none of my commie buddies or anything like this, right? I don't even have any commie buddies, but I know you think, some of you think I do.
Yep.
America's roads, bridges, water system, and energy networks have long been in poor repair. But guess what? They got a better grade. They've been awarded, as a nation, our nation, the richest country in the world, has been awarded a D.
We're not surprised.
It was a D minus.
Oh, it went up?
It went up from a D minus to a D.
How about that?
That's right. Wait a minute. It's up to a, oh no, I'm sorry. It was one grade. It was a D in the last report. Now it's D plus. All right. The report is showing progress in 6 areas, including bridges, rail, wastewater, and drinking water. Gregory DiLoretto, the president of the American Society of Civil Engineers, said a D-plus is simply unacceptable for anyone serious about strengthening our nation's economy. How about safety? I mean, isn't that something?
Sure.
Here's what's happening. We're winding up just like the old Soviet Union. They had the most advanced military in the world that was comparable to ours.
And look at ours.
And the people, most of the people, well, they had an upper crust in Russia, to be sure. Nothing like here, but they had an upper strata.
Yeah.
And the rest of the people, I mean, they weren't.
They were standing in bread lines, let's be real.
No, they weren't in bread lines.
Well, come on. Yes, they were.
They were standing in vodka lines.
and bread lines.
Yeah. No, I mean, there was enough to eat, but housing was pretty miserable, heating systems and all that.
Yeah.
Roads, a lot of corruption and what have you. And that's what we're going. That's the way we're going. The engineering group estimates that the nation needs an investment of about $3.6 trillion by 2020, but the current levels of spending will leave a shortfall of $1.6 trillion. This is where the federal government could easily come in, start spending this money, divert it from the war budget, which is absolutely unneeded, cut the so-called defense budget or military budget at least in half, put this into construction so we'd wind up with good roads and schools and bridges and water systems and stuff like that.
It's what the people deserve.
Yeah, and there would also be all these jobs.
And there's all this wealth. And, earlier tonight I was down picking up some food, and there was this obviously homeless man who came in, and they kind of knew him in there, and so they gave him the food for a dollar, which was so cool. You know, I just – and I talked to the guy a little bit, and he told me, he said – I'm homeless. I'm on the street. And he said, and it is cold out there. And he goes, I'd like to say I get used to it, but I don't. And I almost cried. It just made me so sad, and it made me so mad.
Well, yeah. And then you drive a few miles north.
I felt guilty in my car with a full tank of gas and my own house and, my job in this warm studio, just the whole thing. I just felt sick to my stomach.
Yeah, sometimes I go in a gas station and I said, last person there got
$2 worth of gas.
Yeah, and I just got 54.
Yeah, I just felt sick.
Right. Let's take this call before our break. Here's Bill in Detroit. Bill, hi, you're on the air. It's Peter and Jalene. Thanks for joining us.
Hi, how's it going?
It's going good.
Yeah, I just want to call in. I don't mean to defend Kwame at all, but
we don't hear that very often.
But if you do a little timeline back, the Fed said that they've been investigating for 10 years. That was the exact same time that Bush and Rove and his attorney general had instructed all the federal attorneys to go after Democrats, if you remember.
Well, that could vary. Yeah, that was the case. But I think people's historic and political memory doesn't go back very far. Yeah, they were it was an attempt to find what was there among any Democratic office holders. The problem was that Kwame Kilpatrick gave such an enormous amount of them to go after. And I would hope you would feel the same way. I have zero sympathy for the guy.
I have sympathy for his children.
Yeah. So?
I'm just saying.
Yeah. But
if there's any sympathy, it goes
but,
to them.
Yeah, he destroyed his mother's career, who was in Congress.
Yeah.
I mean, some people say it was the dad was the brains behind it all. But, I don't know what? It didn't intrigue me like so many people in the suburbs were. It's like they lived in Detroit. You know, there was... It's a whole, I don't even know if I want to go where I'm going with that, but the unusual attention paid by suburbanites to
white people, to the
fortunes and the corruption and illegalities of the Kwame Kilpatrick mayoral debacle is, I don't know. I think there's more there than meets the eye.
And they're cushy neighborhoods, and their roads are getting plowed.
Yeah.
Their garbage is getting picked up. The police respond right away.
All right, Bill, thank you very much. Well, and that will lead us in when we come back to this emergency financial manager situation. Detroit's been laying off cops, and there's somebody that's going to put more cops back on the streets, and it's not the financial manager.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Jolene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Peter and Jolene are taking your calls at 313-298-WRIF.
That's what we do.
We'll be taking more of your calls right after this.
Attorney CPA Joe Cordell.
Divorce is never an easy decision, nor should it be. You didn't get married to get divorced, and if your thinking is right, you won't choose divorce when good alternatives exist. Having said that, if you're a man facing divorce, you should know that, like many things in life, timing is important. Too often guys find themselves in a divorce court when their businesses are thriving, when their investments are appreciating, and their income soaring. Not surprisingly, these conditions tend to produce more painful property divisions and richer support orders. The reverse is typically true when men are in less favorable financial circumstances, when their assets and their ability to pay are diminished. My point is simply this. Divorce may make the most sense for men when they can least afford it. Think about it.
Call the domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell, a partner men can count on. Offices in Troy, Novi, and Ann Arbor, 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com.
Detroit.
No, it's on, man.
Great.
Look, this is it. This is it. Fine, let's do it. I'm ready. Go.
Everything that rocks.
I want to hear some real music out there. I want to hear some real music. It's time to testify. I want to know, are you ready to testify? Are you ready? I give you.
Peter and Jolene, you're listening to Night Call, the Rift award-winning talk show on 101 WRIF.
313-298-WRIF.
313-298-9743.
What is it?
Sorry, I'm laughing. Just sometimes watching you over there is entertaining.
Yeah, I'll get it one of these days. Then we have some email for you at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, an email address you can write comments into. Short, simple ones are the best. They might get read. Also, we have a Facebook page. Always interested to see how you react to some of the things we post. And that is facebook.com/nightcall. My website, Peter Werby, W-E-R-B-E.com. I've got so much up here. I don't even know if I can find it right now. But there is a ton of stuff. Oh, yeah, here it is. And I'm going to read from this a little later. A dying Iraq war veteran has written a last letter to Bush and Cheney, accusing them of war crimes, calling them war criminals. And his whole last letter is there. And some of the stuff, how Iraq was destroyed by antique cold warriors. This is these leftover Reaganoids in the service of pirate capitalists, because everybody lost except for the people who had money invested. The Halliburtons, the the oil companies didn't quite do as well as they thought. Mostly China. Remember, this was a war for oil, and now Chinese oil has got it all. Another article: 10 years after the Iraq invasion, hundreds of thousands killed. I mean, that's how bad this all was. But
I just feel, you know, I actually feel guilty sometimes about how you remember how mad I used to get. I mean. You had to talk me off the ledge during this whole thing when it began. You remember? And I just, I don't get mad enough anymore about it. So,
Well, like everything else the left says and criticizes the mainstream, both the Democrats and the Republicans, particularly the Republicans in the right wing, we're always right about it. I mean, they marginalize the hundreds of millions of people around the world that knew there were no weapons of mass destruction, yeah, that Bush was lying, that Cheney was lying, that Colin Powell was lying, that Condoleezza Rice was lying. The whole pack of them were lying, that there was no connection between 9/11 and Iraq. And this was something that these fools thought could be just an easy win, about a week, and boom, it would all be gone. And then there would be this staunch American ally in Baghdad that would give over all the oil concessions that Saddam Hussein had plucked away from the West years before. And instead, this is the mess. And now, and the mess is here, with what's happened to the soldiers that were sent over there, and a worse mess over there. What Ralph Nader calls sociocide. Essentially, a society was killed, was murdered, was destroyed. And
well,
it continues today.
One of the biggest refugee situations in the world.
Sure, without a doubt. And, here. I mean, actually, where was this thing? Maggie O'Kane, who is the executive producer of a new documentary from the Guardian newspaper in England about Iraq, which is, quote, one of the great untold stories of the Iraq War, how just over a year after the invasion, the United States funded a sectarian police commando force that set up a network of torture centers to fight the insurgency. It was a decision that helped fuel a sectarian civil war between Shiite and Sunni that ripped the country apart. They'd lived in peace for a long time. They didn't like it.
Relative peace,
but they weren't fighting. Let's see here. Raed Jarar, who was born in Baghdad, he was in there in 2003. He says, as we feared, President George W. Bush launched his war of choice. There was no need for it. On March 20th, we survived, but we were among the lucky ones. Millions of Iraqis have been killed, injured, or displaced. One of the most developed countries in the region at the time of the invasion, Iraq now is among the worst in terms of infrastructure and public services. Baghdad ranks lowest in the quality of life of any city in the world.
Yeah.
And this is because of George Bush. This is because of Dick Cheney. This is because of all those lying Republicans that every death, every injury, every PTSD, every loss of limb is right at the doorstep of these lying.
Yeah. The blood is on their hands.
Yeah.
A friend of mine grew up, was born out in a village right outside of Baghdad. And he told me he's got, I don't know, four or five kids now, and they live here in the area. And he said, I tell my kids, you don't hate anyone, but you hate George Bush. I'm sorry. I love this guy.
This Raed Jarar, he says, I am half Sunni and half Shiite, or sushi, as Iraqis jokingly call kids of mixed marriages. I was never asked my sect before 2003. I did not know who from my friends was a Sunni or a Shiite until then. But now these sectarian divisions have become a core component of Iraq's new identity, and they continue to threaten its territorial integrity and national unity. This is what George Bush caused, for sure.
What a mess he made.
All right, speaking about a mess, today, Kevin Orr, the newly appointed emergency financial manager. We're going to have a
conversation
in Detroit. We're going to have a conversation about that with Tom Stevens from the National Lawyers Guild at 1 a.m. Eastern Time. It'll be available on our podcast as well, it's available from our site or from WRIF.com or from
WhiteRoseSociety.org.
Yeah, any of those places. And this is incredibly crucial. Now, one of the things that's going to happen, I think the Kevin Orr's salary is going to be $275,000.
Are you serious?
Yeah. I'm willing to do this.
You're going to do some math on the
No, I'm going to do it for, I would do it, they didn't ask me. I would do it for $225,000, saving 50 grand right out of the box. And all you got to do is smash all the unions, privatize and outsource.
Which you would never do.
Sell off the assets and, get rid of all the contracts and then boom. Because if you're looking at things because it's pretty easy. If you're spending $100 and all you have is $75, you gotta somehow figure out how to only spend $75, right?
Sure.
Question is, why did your deal go down so badly?
Yeah.
And it could be a lot of things. Some of it could be your own fault. I'm talking about if you're a person. Sometimes it's not your fault at all. Sometimes you had a real good job. You're working as hard as you could.
And then poof.
And poof. Yeah. The rug is pulled out from under you by forces over which you have absolutely no control and probably didn't even anticipate. Certainly, when all these commitments were made to City of Detroit workers for pensions that total up now to like $15 billion, no one thought this was going to happen to the City of Detroit. No one thought that that the great industrial powers of the United States were going to figure they could care less about our cities, less about their workers, less about the communities in which they live, and more about getting absolutely more money into their coffers to give to the 1% and send the labor overseas and have their products manufactured overseas. So that's where the real fault lies. Now, there's two congressmen, Conyers and Gary Peters, are asking for an investigation into how the emergency managers throughout the state have managed federal money in the school districts and municipalities that they've taken over. And the record isn't real good. Not real good at all, because
is it Benton Harbor and
Pontiac and Ecorse and Taylor?
Yeah.
All these cities like that. All are in trouble. And again, I don't know. This sounds just like a rhetorical question. In other words, a question I'm not really looking for an answer for, but I really am looking for an answer. Why in the richest country in the world does this happen? You know? I mean, Kwame Kilpatrick? This was going on.
They're probably going back to Coleman.
Coleman. Yeah. This is two black men that white people get to call by their first name. They like that.
That's right.
You used to be able to do that in the South. You know, you called, you know, every black man, no matter how old he was, by his first name, if you weren't calling him boy. Now, though, yeah. So, I mean, you know, if you imagine that, if people in the suburb, they say, well, Coleman, you're like, where are they, where did they get this from?
Yeah.
You know, where do they get the right to, you know, to have that kind of familiarity? Kwame, I was going to say, if you talk about Kilpatrick, they're thinking, who's this Irish guy? You know, Irish guy? Yeah, they wouldn't even know who he is. Right? So what's happening? If you reduce expenditures in these cash-strapped cities to revenue, well, you're going to have this incredibly reduced services.
Yeah,
there's gonna be nothing
and it's
there.
Already not good.
Yeah, and they're selling off like all these assets and all this. But hey, you know, a lot of these conservatives say what we got to get is the free market. Well, the free market is stepped up. They are Penske Auto, Quicken Loans, Ford, General Motors, Chrysler, Blue Cross, Blue Shield of Michigan. What's going to happen? They are going to donate police cars, emergency vehicles, and financial assistance to the city, according to the Detroit Free Press.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So isn't that nice? Well, you're thinking, isn't that nice?
Well, it just sounds nice.
Well, it's more charity. I mean, and charity is...
It should be taken care of. It shouldn't have to be the private sector that's dealing with this.
It's charity is always hierarchical. It's those at the top exercising their largesse, which is they should. But this should actually be in the tax structure.
It's what a lot of wealthy women with nothing better to do with their time than they've got to have a charity.
Well, I think that, you know, the Penske's and the Quicken Loans and the Ford and the GM and the Blue Cross people, they really don't want to see Detroit go down the tubes.
Yeah.
I mean, so they're
they have vested interests.
Yeah, they have vested interests, which is good. I mean, it's good to move people like that. The best thing to move around is you know, an ethical and moral approach to your actions. But and I'm sure a lot of people within these corporations have that sense of they don't want to see people live in the kind of poverty and lack of services and what have you. But I don't think it ever does occur to them is what is in the structure of this economy and this social system and this economic system that allows such disparity that they need to donate, that they need to have charities. Is that and everything that we're charitable. I mean, think about I can't even think. What's that charity every year?
Which one?
Well, you know, the big one. Boy, I'm just a total blank on it. But anyway, you know, and they always want you to contribute at work and what have you.
I don't know.
Okay. But
there's so many.
Yeah, but the question is, why should there even be, the need for that? You know what I'm saying? Why
absolutely,
should
absolutely, Peter?
Yeah, why should we be digging in our pockets for money for homeless shelters? And then you go back a little more. Why are there homeless?
Yeah. What? Like my experience with the homeless guy tonight, it was heartbreaking.
Yeah. By the way, we were talking earlier. I never got to.
We were talking about gay marriage. We were talking about gay marriage.
So Jim writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Here's a simple solution about gay marriage. If you oppose same-sex marriage, don't marry somebody of the same sex. If you oppose abortion, don't have one. Focus, and this is good advice to people that want to intervene in the lives of other people. Focus more on living your own life as you choose and allowing others to do the same. Thanks for making another night in the steel mill more tolerable. That's amazing.
Wow.
You know what's amazing?
That he can hear in the steel mill.
That there's a steel mill in Detroit.
Isn't there one right by our station? There's some kind of a...
Yeah. What is it? I see it all. I can say it.
Oh, okay.
Why can't I say it? If I can remember it, I could say it.
Okay.
Begins with an O.
I can't remember. No, it begins with an E. Isn't it Eaton?
Eaton. Yeah. Oh, yeah. That's close. Stephen writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com talking about... Iraq. He says the Iraq war was worth it. Cheney made millions. Dick Cheney and his friends, Halliburton stock went up 800% between October 1st, 2001 and October 8th. 800%. It's called war profiteering.
That's right.
And these are the people that have an approval rating. I mean, it's not high, but it's still, I don't know, Cheney.
It's even in the, I mean, it's the 40th percentile. I can't even believe it.
Yeah, I mean, you got a guy like Cheney that sounds like Darth Vader. And, you know, he likes it that he was called Darth Vader.
He does, because Darth was dark and evil.
Yeah, and he talks like this, so. And
he likes being mean.
And now Bush just goes back to, he kind of comes across now as just a goofball frat boy that,
he always came across as a goofball.
Well, yeah, remember that they used to have Bushisms?
Books.
Books on all the malapropisms, all the things.
Mistakes in his English.
Well, did I say this last week? I don't remember. But the fact that the brand new emergency financial manager for Detroit comes from this law firm called Jones Day. I think we were saying this earlier tonight.
Wait, with how many attorneys?
2,400. And where he is...
That is the biggest law firm ever.
Well, you know what? I wouldn't be so sure. He resigns from Jones Day. And then the next day, the Jones Day law firm becomes the law firm for the city of Detroit that's overseeing its restructuring.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, isn't there... The people are protesting tomorrow, right?
They are. Today.
Today.
Right, yeah. And I'm not sure of the times, but there was a meeting yesterday at a church. 500 people attended and said they are not going to allow this attack, this assault on the city of Detroit by these banks, the banksters, essentially, that created the mess in the first place.
I got to find out this when this is and the time.
Someone out there knows. 313-298-WRIF. See, here is the problem, though. They're right. What's going to essentially happen is these people of wealth are going to come into the city, including this law firm. The city is going to be stripped of everything that has any worth to it. Everybody involved is going to make hundreds of thousands to millions of dollars, and we're going to have this incredibly diminished city. But there is a crisis in the city of Detroit. It does not have the money to enable to finance its needs. So what's got to happen is that the people that don't want the emergency financial manager, they've got to say, instead, we want to. Then fill in the blank.
Yeah.
And one of the things is the state could provide more shared revenue, since one of the things that that Governor Snyder did was to diminish. That's why our city is our little suburb is having the problems, because one of the problems is that that the revenue sharing was reduced.
Hey, I just want to do a shout out to Dean in Plymouth, who said something about send in an email. Is this show taped from 8 years ago? Dean, if you're not listening, my friend, Dean in Plymouth, I just want to point something out for you. This is the 10th anniversary of the Iraq War. That's why we're talking about it. Carry on.
Yeah, thank you. Butch Hollowell. Incredible guy, actually. General counsel for the Detroit NAACP. He says the new emergency manager comes from a firm, Jones Day, that represents Wells Fargo, which is the leader in foreclosures in our state, which participated in one of the largest fraudulent robocalling schemes. They force people out of their homes and then don't pay property taxes on their properties. Jones Day represents the Amway Corporation.
Oh, no.
The right to work legislation. Jones Day represents the Bank of America and Lehman, whose actions sunk our economy and then got billions in taxpayer bailout funds. And he says, where's Detroit's bailout fund? The news emergency manager is the diversity chairman at his firm in a virtually all-white firm. He's the diversity.
He's
Mr. Diversity. Mm-hmm. Yeah. He says the emergency manager statute allows for dissolving the legislative body, and this unelected official, this new emergency manager, enacts statutes, essentially. So my vote in Detroit, Michigan, does not equal the vote of someone in Grand Rapids. He says this violates the Voting Rights Act. So one of the things that's going to happen, I think there's going to be these great legal challenges
to
all of this. Yeah. But the other thing is, you went in, if you lived in the city of Detroit, which neither Julian nor I do, and you voted for council members, you voted for city treasurer, you voted for the mayor, and a guy comes in and says, you know, you're toast, you're out of here. I mean, this I don't think this can be.
It doesn't make a whole lot of
legal
sense.
Let's go back and get another call. There's open lines. Here's Mike in Fenton. Mike, hi, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hey, how you doing?
We're good.
I wanted to talk about that city of Detroit, but I think that, what do you call it, that right for work state starts Thursday also.
It does.
Yeah, we're on a roll.
You can say that again.
Yeah. So we voted, told them no. So they come in, and they're going to give us 24 attorneys, and it only took one attorney to shut down the city the first time. Now we're going to have 2,400 of them. It's going to be good.
Well, I want to see this. There's an article in the Detroit News from yesterday. It says, fired up crowd plans Detroit emergency manager protest. So they're not talking. I mean, every other city is just taking this lying down. Or is it laying down? But I don't know.
That one always gets
me. It always gets me. But the point being is that there's got to be positive solution. In fact, an old friend, I just heard him on a New York radio station. In fact, the Frank Joyce, who has been on the show any number of times, and Dave Marsh, who is the biographer of Bruce Springsteen and actually was one of the first writers for Cream Magazine here in Detroit and what have you. And Frank was saying on Dave's show today, he said that people now they're being called solutionists.
As in, like, people who?
That are beginning to figure out solutions for Detroit beyond just austerity. Because that's what's happened all over the world. There's this crisis of capitalism, and the people in charge say, okay, we got to take it out of the hides of the people who didn't do anything, who worked their hardest, who were playing their roles perfectly. Think about that. Everybody involved in Detroit and in Madrid and in Rome and Dublin, everywhere. They were playing their prescribed roles. You know what they were doing? They were going to work and doing what they were told to do, right?
Yeah.
Anytime there was a contract, like a union contract or anything like that, the company agreed to it. They said, okay, that'll work. That'll work with our projected long-term financial picture and all of that. So these folks didn't do anything. But now, suddenly, they're suffering job loss, pay reduction, city services being eliminated, and all of that. So the wrong people are paying for this. It's the banksters that should be doing it. All right, Mike, thanks a lot. We have some open lines for you, 313-298-WRIF. And Daywan Ron writes in, because we were talking about marriage equality earlier. I have a cousin who is gay. His parents are good old Christian folk. His dad is an ex-preacher from a small town, so you get the idea.
Mm-hmm.
When my cousin came out to them, they disowned him and told him he was not their son. Well, now he has a great job with Google, makes lots of money, and buys them anything they want.
Wow.
So now he's their favorite son. Oddly enough, according to them, now he always was. He always was
their favorite son.
Right.
Yeah,
jerks,
sure.
He says.
Amazing. Money is so evil.
Yeah, you know, though, that's not always the case. I mean, these, religion and prejudice goes so deep in certain people. Fortunately, it's a minority of the people that it wouldn't matter.
You know. Absolutely. And there are a lot of religious people who put that aside or you know, have the sense of mind when their kids are gay. They're just like, hey, you're my kid. I love you.
Yeah. I mean, I can imagine, and it depends on where you're standing. For one thing, if you're steeped in religious opposition to homosexuality, that's one thing. But
that's a tough one.
Yeah. But
to get out of.
But also, if you're a straight parent, and you have a kid. I'm saying this, neither Jaleen nor I have any kids, but this is what I'm assuming. And if you want to comment on this, let me know. In fact, if
we only have furry kids.
We have furry kids.
Yeah.
313-298-WRIF will get you on the air. I'm sure most everyone who has a child also thinks about having a grandchild. And
they still can if their kids are gay.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Well, they can't in the manner that they anticipated. And also that they know that their child is going to be suffering a lot of discrimination and a lot of hurt and a lot of prejudice.
That's up to the parent to, I mean, my gosh, my gay friends who have kids, the way these kids are so advanced, you know, socially, psychologically, and if someone makes fun of them at school, their responses are just brilliant. You know,
you mean when kids make fun of their parents?
When the kids make fun of the kids for having gay parents?
Yeah, that's what I mean.
Yeah,
but somewhere along the line, I had that thing from the American Pediatrics Association that said, here it is. If you're just joining us, the American Academy of Pediatrics declared its support for same-sex marriage for the first time, saying that allowing gay and lesbian parents to marry if they so choose is in the best interest of their children.
So there you go.
So they were all. And remember, there was also an article about these conservative kids, not kids, young people, 18 to 29, and they're in this teeny minority because 81% of people between 18 and 29 support marriage equality.
And the reason it's a hot button issue, if you're just joining, because, you know, that happens all the time, radios go on, radios go off, is that in the Supreme Court, there are a couple pieces of legislation regarding gay marriage going on this week, starting Tuesday.
That they're going to be examining, yeah. Tuesday and Wednesday, big anti-marriage equality demonstrations going to occur. Anti-marriage equality.
Oh, the antis are going to be there?
The conservatives.
Oh, okay.
See, that's where they get the name. They want to conserve inequality, just like they want to conserve.
They want to keep the people down.
Yeah, they want to conserve segregation. I know they were Democrats. They want to conserve. The exclusion of a woman's right to choose. They wanted to conserve a situation where there were no unions. They wanted to conserve a situation
slavery.
Where women couldn't vote.
Did you already say that?
Okay. Well, I didn't get it. I was going back.
All right.
So everything that a conservative wants to conserve is things we've had to fight like hell to get over, including a goddamn civil war.
Yeah.
Really, son of a bitches, man.
Peter.
I mean, I am just so tired of these people.
I am too.
You know, do you realize?
They disgust me.
So here, you know, I mean, for one thing, the South. I mean, I'm getting back to all this.
To the good old South?
The good old South who screwed up this country right from the beginning with their demand for inclusion of protection of slavery and the slave trade.
Yeah.
And getting disproportionate power because they could actually count the slaves as 3/5 of
a person.
Can you imagine this if it wasn't for them? And unfortunately, the North needed them. The Northern colonies needed them in order to have a successful rebellion. So they gave in. They compromised. But could you imagine if it wasn't for them, they could say, okay, we're putting white Christian men, property men, that can vote. And someone said, you know, that's not fair. It says equal protection of the law. And they go, yeah, you know, you're right. We got to let women and unpropertied people and people of color and gay people and all that. And this could have been like 1790. And they go,
right.
Okay, and then we could have lived happily ever after. Right?
Yeah.
Happily ever after.
Instead of in this cesspool of hate and ignorance.
Yeah, yeah. And stemming from, and the conservatives have fought to maintain the discrimination all throughout the history of this country, throughout the world.
You can't argue with facts.
Yeah. One of the things, though, that, you know, we've been asking for years now for someone to tell us, how would how is marriage defended by excluding gay couples from marrying? No one ever comes up with a thing. But remember, if you were listening, I read that you've excluded the norm of sexual complementarity, which we didn't understand. And we're hoping maybe someone would call 313-298-WRIF. What does sexual complementarity mean?
But, I think what they're saying is, you know, that it's natural for a man and a woman, but it's not natural any other way.
They complement each other. Because, I got it.
I've been thinking about this.
But once you exclude that norm, says this conservative, three other norms, which are monogamy, sexual exclusivity, and permanency, become optional as well. But that's happening now. And these frauds, these conservatives, these Christians, these Republicans, they're off the board. Remember,
all Christians. Let's not get crazy.
Remember the Governor Mark Sanford of South Carolina?
Yeah, now he had that little thing going with that woman in South America.
He did,
right?
Remember,
he said he was hiking the Appalachian Trail,
which gives you his side piece. Yeah, that's what wives say to their husbands now. You better not be hiking the Appalachian Trail.
I actually have a friend who's hiking it right now, for real.
That's what he says.
No, she really is.
That's what she says.
Yeah.
But he is running for Congress, and former Governor Mark Sanford, back from the Appalachian Trail, which led to a divorce, ethics charges, and censure, he won the highest number of Republican votes in the primary there. But he's going to have a runoff. He's got the most votes. 15% of the people turned out for this. But you know who won for the Democrats?
Who?
What's her name here? Elizabeth Colbert Bush, B-U-S-C-H, like in the beer.
Okay.
And
I knew it was. And she was a lone rebel.
Yeah, she is the sister of Stephen Colbert.
Oh!
Isn't that cool?
Yeah, it is cool.
Yeah, so can you imagine Stephen Colbert having Mark Sanford be his sister's opposition?
Oh my gosh.
Great fun.
That is good fun.
Great fun. All right, 313-298-WRIF. Here is Steve in Davison. Hey, Steve, you're on the air. Welcome.
Hi, how are you doing tonight?
We're good. Thanks for calling in.
Hey, I'm one of them people that are, I'm just kind of sick and tired of what our government's doing, and I want to get a protest started.
Good idea. About what?
let's start with undoing what the Supreme Court did by saying that corporations could give money to campaigns unlimitedly,
the Citizens United decision that said that money is speech and that to forbid corporations from dumping hundreds of millions of dollars into the political process was speech. And usually it's thought of as what they call equivalency. They could say, well, the unions put in, you know, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars as well. Well, the unions, and, you know, being a union member, I can tell you, do not want to do that. The corporations know that they get an enormous return on their investment. So they may put in tens of millions, but because of the legislation, the politicians they can buy and the legislation that they can write for these politicians is it's just part of their doing business. But, you know, I'll tell you, Steve, there is a movement afoot to actually amend the United States Constitution, and someone is going to have to call in and remind me. But do you use the computer?
I do.
Okay, good. Probably now everybody does. A few years ago.
No, still. There's some people who still aren't on.
If they don't, God bless
them. My boyfriend is not on the computer.
Good for him.
I know. No Facebook, no nothing.
If you Google Citizens United, try like Citizens United Reform or Abolish Citizens United, and I think you'll come up with some people that are doing stuff. And what's hard, though, whether you've got some pals or you belong to an organization or something like that, but if you're all by yourself, and I don't care whether it's a little city like Davison or a bigger city around Detroit like we are, if you're all by yourself, you're pretty isolated. You're just, you know, like watching stuff or reading stuff or, you know, looking at websites and just getting outraged. And so you go, well, where do I go? But one of the things you got to do is you got to hook up with real live human beings. I mean, you'll find petitions online and stuff like that. But the real thing is, the getting together with people.
Well, that's what I want to do, April 15th, outside of every federal building in the country.
There you go.
Be there.
There you go. Is there something happening in Davison?
Well, there's no federal buildings in Davison, but I'll be in Flint.
Yeah. Well, that's good.
Well, keep us posted.
But one of the things is that some people want to operate completely by themselves, completely as autonomous individuals, and no problem with that at all. But you might find that there's some like-minded people down there, and they might be planning some special way of presenting their concerns about things that you're talking about. So. I'll tell you, do this, Steve, if you want only, of course, write us at calltalkyes@yahoo.com, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. And, if you want me to look for something in your area, if you're not finding it, and, I'll see what I can shoot you. Okay.
Okay.
All right. Good.
All right.
Good,
thanks
good.
For calling.
Yeah. I mean, that's, it's getting to be a cliche about, I'm mad as hell. I'm not going to take it anymore.
Right.
But we got to start fighting back, people, because Detroit's going to be everywhere soon. Well, not absolutely everywhere, but most places. And we're going to be run by little dictators. All right. Coming back at you. And
we got some callers on hold, and your last chance to call in for the night in the next segment.
Yeah, Mike from Clyde. We got a lot of listeners in Clyde.
We do.
We do, indeed. I wonder, I'm going to ask Mike when we get back whether they're all in the same house or or what, but we'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby and Julene Jordan on 101 WRIF. Let your opinion be heard. Call us at 313-298-WRIF.
Whatever's going on, it seems to be far from over.
Peter and Julene will be taking more of your calls right after this.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today, because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
Surface, lost under the surface. Don't want you to say, I'm angry. It's okay. I'll process my anger. I love myself. Woozah.
Whatever your name is, get ready for the big surprise.
At the base.
Welcome to WRIF's award-winning Night Call, Detroit's longest-running phone and talk show with Peter Werby and Julie Jordan. Peter and Julie will be voicing their opinions, and they want to hear yours. Call them at 313-298-WRIF.
Just do what I tell you.
That's 313-298-9743. Now, here are Peter and Julie.
All right, thank you very much, and this is our final segment. Give us a call, 313-298-WRIF. At 1 a.m., which is coming up here in the East very quickly, Tom Stevens, a National Lawyers Guild lawyer, will be... Boy, that was a hard one to figure, wasn't it?
Good job.
He's going to be talking about the emergency financial manager. This guy knows more about the city of Detroit and about another than... any other about 14 people put together. And, you know, this these recorded interviews air on some of our sister stations as well. And they're early Sunday morning, so I rarely get any mail. I've got a ton of mail, emails on this already.
Well, maybe, you know, it's a hot-button issue. More people are listening than you think.
And one guy wrote and said he wanted a written transcript of it. And I said, okay, I'll get on it. No, I won't.
Do you know how long that would take?
Yeah, it would take a long time.
Hey, Peter, pay me and I'll transcribe it for
you. I used to transcribe a lot of these interviews.
I did medical transcription.
Did you?
Yeah.
I used to transcribe some of these interviews, and they would appear in the Metro Times.
Oh, yeah.
Which we got an award from.
Which we love the Metro Times.
Yeah.
We got a little award.
I would say maybe 20 interviews, maybe 25 interviews,
yeah.
Particularly in the 90s. Yeah. We're talking about marriage equality. Terry writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. He says, my siblings and I are in the 39 to 47 age group, and all of us accepted our father when he came out as gay back in the early 90s. He now lives with his partner
in Vegas.
In Vegas.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, that's great. Good for you, Terry. You're what, good kids.
Did we look at these? Nothing in that message. I just wanted to get this on. All right. This is Dave from Livonia. While I agree the voters' rights are completely silent, something had to be done. Clearly, for years and years, there's been mismanagement and corruption. No books for the school kids, yet officials are being chauffeured in Escalades. Let's get a look at the books. Well, no problem with that. There are every bureaucracy in the world probably has some degree of mismanagement. And the corruption was mostly prevalent under Kwame Kilpatrick. But these were relatively petty sums. This is not the problem. The problem is this massive reduction in revenues that occurred, both because of the deindustrialization of the city, the tax base collapsing, property values.
The property tax is not getting paid. I mean, that's...
Yeah, yeah. So, no, the problem has not been mismanagement and corruption. The problem is much greater than that. The fact that there was mismanagement, the fact that there has been corruption, which should be absolutely weeded out, and the fact that these officials should not be chauffeured around in anything. Right? I mean,
drive your own ass around.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, for sure. But mostly that's just sort of a stick in the eye. You know, let me put it another way. I mean, the stick in the eye, it really hurts. It's sort of adding insult to injury. I mean,
Salt
on the wound. Yeah, indeed. I just got a message from our producer, but that's...
Wait, I want to go look. You keep going.
No, it's nothing that needs to be. I mean, it's only one word.
Oh.
What else? Oh, also, Sam Husseini, who is the communications director for the Institute for Public Accuracy,
been there forever. He's great.
And he's going to talk about this 10th anniversary of the Iraq War. And I don't think enough can be said about this. And, you know, it's funny. It's like everyone's over it. I almost get the feeling that those of you that are listening, or those of you who know people, well, let me then finish the sentence. Well, those of you who are listening that were over there, that fought in it, that came home unscathed, or those of you who came home with grievous wounds, or saw your comrades injured and killed. it seems to not be this huge part of the world any longer. It went away so quickly.
That's right. To the point where we're getting emails about, why are you still talking about this?
Yeah.
Well, you know, that's a problem. We should still be talking about this.
Because some president along the line, hopefully it won't be Barack Obama, is going to say, you know, the information we have leads us to believe that that military action by the United States is, you know, and boom, there we are in a war with fill in the blank. And usually little countries, you know, the United States gave up on fighting the big ones a long time ago because, well, the you know, you wind up with 400,000 dead like in World War II. It's not a good deal. So what they just thought, well, we could make easy, an easy deal with Korea, which of course didn't turn out to be the case. Worse with Vietnam.
Yeah.
And the worst part of it, the worst part of it is always us, no matter how few the casualties are. If we have 4,500 or 4,800 American dead in the Iraq War, that's enormous to us. The fact that they don't even know. 100,000, 200,000 Iraqis dead. That's, you know, it doesn't even come into the consciousness of most of us. But here, let's go at this letter. And this is on my website at Peter Werbe, W-E-R-B-E.com. Also on our Facebook page, which is facebook.com/nightcall. An Iraq war veteran who joined the U.S. Army 2 days after 9/11 has written a powerful open letter to former President George W. Bush and ex-Vice President Dick Cheney, accusing them of war crimes, plunder, and the murder of thousands of young Americans. He says, my fellow veterans whose future you stole. And if you were there, if you know somebody was there, pop in at any time and tell me if you think that Thomas Young, who was shot and paralyzed during an insurgent attack in Saturday City in 2004, it was just 5 days after his first deployment. He's under hospice care right now. He was considering committing suicide, and he said at the end, he said, this way, instead of committing the conventional suicide, I am out of the picture. People have a way to stop by or call and say their goodbyes. And Thomas Young said, I felt this was a fairer way to treat people than just go out with a note.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
Well, and there are a lot of, there's a large group of veterans who, the IVAW, the Iraq Veterans Against the War, that are active in this country. And I think more and more are thinking along those lines.
Absolutely.
All the time.
Well, they can tell us. 313-298-WRIF. Here is part of Thomas Young's letter. The whole letter is on my website and on our Facebook page. I write this letter, my last letter to you, Mr. Bush and Mr. Cheney. I write not because I think you grasp the terrible human and moral consequences of your lies, manipulation, and thirst for wealth and power. I write this letter because, before my own death, I want to make it clear that I and hundreds of thousands of my fellow veterans, along with millions of my fellow citizens, along with hundreds of millions more in Iraq and the Middle East, know fully who you are and what you have done. You may evade justice, but in our eyes you are each guilty of egregious war crimes, of plunder, and finally of murder, including the murder of thousands of young Americans, my fellow veterans, whose future you stole. This is an Iraq veteran who is dying. I joined the Army 2 days after the 9/11 attacks. I joined the Army because our country had been attacked. I wanted to strike.
Which happened a lot.
Yeah. I wanted to strike back at those who had killed some 3,000 of my fellow citizens.
But it wasn't them.
Well, he says, yeah. I did not join the Army to go to Iraq, a country that had no part in the September 2001 attacks and did not pose a threat to its neighbors, much less the United States. I did not join the Army to liberate Iraqis or shut down mythical weapons of mass destruction facilities or to implant what you cynically call democracy in Baghdad and the Middle East. I did not join the Army to rebuild Iraq, which at the time you told us could be paid for by Iraq's oil revenues. Instead, we're probably like $1 trillion in debt and counting, and that didn't happen. Young believes he was injured fighting the wrong war. He goes on in his letter, I would not be writing this letter if I'd been wounded fighting in Afghanistan against those forces that carried out the attacks in 9/11. Had I been wounded there, I would still be miserable because of my physical deterioration and imminent death, but I would at least have the comfort of knowing that my injuries were a consequence of my own decision to defend the country I love. I would not have to lie in my bed, my body filled with painkillers, my life, I don't know if I can read this, my life ebbing away, and deal with the fact that hundreds of thousands of human beings, including children, including myself, were sacrificed by you for little more than the greed of oil companies for your alliance with the oil sheikhs of in Saudi Arabia and your insane visions of empire.
Wow.
This is an American veteran dying in a hospice in a open letter to Bush and Cheney.
Oh. That's haunting.
Let's see. There's a movie called Body of War that was a documentary made by Phil Donahue.
Oh, really?
When Thomas Young saw President Bush on television speaking from the ruins of the Twin Towers, his life changed. This is according to his biography on the Body of War website. As his training began at Fort Hood, he assumed that he would be shipped off to Afghanistan where the terrorist camps were based, routing out Al-Qaeda and Taliban warriors. But soon Bush ordered the invasion of Iraq. In an interview with, and this is a great site, truthdig.com, Young, who suffered an anoxic brain injury in 2008, said he'd been contemplating conventional suicide, but decided to go on hospice care, stop feeding, and fade away.
Oh, God. That is so depressing.
It is. And this is what George Bush,
and
this is the legacy of George Bush.
This is why we're talking about it.
Yep. Here's Mike and Clyde. Mike, thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. You're on the air. Welcome.
Oh, thank you. Sorry, I was trying to get on hold before my cell phone let go.
Oh, it's okay.
Welcome back.
Yeah. I've been around for a while. I'm back in the 60s during Nam and all that. I was actually in the Navy, so I wasn't serving over there, but I served during that time. And what happened is right around that era, the people had the middle class actually had a little bit of free time for pleasure, and their kids, a lot of them went to college, and they found out what was going on. And with the free time, a little extra money, and the knowledge they were learning, they realized what the corporations are doing. Ever since then, they've made sure the middle class has never had any time or money to do that anymore. The kids in college always have to have jobs so that they can't talk about what's going on. They're just being taught one way. They're not thinking about everything that's happening around them.
Well, it's not critical thinking that's high regarded now. What it is, I mean, how do you get job skills and how can you get enough money
right
to pay back your student loan?
Yeah, and that's what they want people to focus on. And then in 73, when they really started jacking the oil up, and that's another way they got the money out of the hands of the middle class. The upper's going more and taking more out of it, and we're just trying to survive so people don't have the time or money to protest or really pay attention to what's going on around them.
You know, there never was a middle class up until the 20th century. I mean, before it was just the elite, and then a small strata of middle class manager, middle level managers. But most people were just workers and farmers, and they pretty much had to accept whatever they were given. Beginning in the middle of the 1880s. And for the next 50 years, there was these intense struggles for workers to be recognized as human beings, to have full lives, and it culminated in the 1930s. It took a capitalist crisis of immense proportion to just realize that the economic system couldn't provide for people, that it needed government intervention. But even still, they weren't willing to do it, because what was present then were these huge mass movements of workers who said, hey, you've got to give us the wherewithal to live. We're willing to work, but we're not willing to be peasants any longer. So the government intervened. There was billions of dollars that were pumped into the economy by the government. There was laws, minimum wages, and what have you. And then Roosevelt backed off because there was always these pressure on him to not have, the conservatives. They didn't want to have so much. And they remember, the conservatives opposed everything: Social Security, the minimum wage, the right to organize in unions, everything they opposed. Everything that we think of being part of a middle class life, the conservatives, who were essentially just the mouthpieces for the rich, they oppose anything for the average person and still do. Then in the late 1930s, Roosevelt kind of backed off it because he was getting all this pressure from the conservatives, and bam, got hit with another recession. And the only thing that got us really out of the depression of the 1930s was enormous government spending on World War II. That was it. And there was a, you know, a depression, looked like a depression could happen again if we pulled the rug out from under all that government spending. So, you know, they had to invent the Cold War, that Russia was going to take over the world unless we continued this huge military-industrial complex. By the 1970s, a lot of it expanded economically, so we had a middle class, so that average worker could afford a nice house in Detroit or in the suburbs and, you know, have some leisure time in the 40-hour week.
What he was talking about before.
Yeah, everything like that. But then it really began to crash, and then Reaganomics, which is all about, without them ever saying it, destroying the middle class and returning the average person to peasantry and to take away all safeguards. Remember all these people talking about free market, that the government doesn't have any right to intervene in private industry, which means they don't even want any safety protection or anything like that. All right, I got to get one more call in. So, Mike, thanks a lot. Here's Rob in Livonia. Rob, thanks for joining us.
No problem. I like you guys' show, and I just wanted to touch bases with you on that letter that the veteran wrote.
Yeah.
If you could kind of just, you know, be with me on this. I'm not trying to cause an issue here. It's just I understand. I feel terrible for what happened. Obviously, I've never been in combat.
We only have about 3 minutes, so just so you know.
No problem. When we sign up for the military, any military, we forget that we are the property of the United States government, which is true. They can send us anywhere we want. We have no choice there.
Right.
So when we go there, and then obviously 10, 15 years later, we write a letter like this saying, well, you know, I didn't want to go there to do this. Listen, you had no choice. You get benefits when you join. So nobody comes to my door and knocks on my door and tells me, you know what, oh, you have to come. You got to, you know, I take the oldest child in the family. You got to come to the Army. No. We walk in on our own 2 feet and sign up for all the benefits that come with it. So when somebody writes a letter like this and obviously, you know, bitching about, you know, the past regime and this and that, they were wealthy, this, they did it for oil, you have no choice in that. You have no choice where I send
right.
you here. You're my property now.
Right.
You're the United States government property. So we forget that part and we go, oh, we feel so bad. Oh my God, Bush and Cheney were horrible.
Yeah, well, they lied. They lied. This kid, they lied to this kid.
Well,
that's what he's saying.
And what he's essentially saying too is there's no political or legal consequences that he's dying. And you're right that a soldier can be used. There's a famous cartoon this huge, huge man without a head carrying a rifle and this general looking at him and saying, ah, the perfect soldier.
Right, yeah.
Well, except we're supposed to be citizen soldiers, and particularly since there's no draft, that men and women that volunteered out of a, you know, often, not always, but usually out of a sense of duty, and there was a big rush after 9/11. And these people were played, and they were played by the Bushes and the Cheneys and the whole supporting apparatus.
You had everyone convinced that it was the Iraqis who got on those planes. It was the Saudis.
And I know what you're saying, and to me, maybe that's a good idea for no one ever to join. Because you don't know, I mean, most of the wars...
Well, you're being sold.
Yeah, there hasn't been a war since World War II that wasn't based completely or to some extent on a lie. And all of it created the such incredible damage to the people that fought it, and certainly to the people that were on the other end of the American military machine. Millions and millions and millions of people have been killed by the U.S. military since the end of 1945, and virtually none of it was necessary ever to occur. Why people join? Well, I don't know. Maybe we should
talk about it. It's a variety of reasons.
We should talk about that another time. But unfortunately, Rob,
we have to go.
So,
thanks for calling.
Yeah, call earlier. We can rejoin this conversation, but not next week because we should have announced
that
earlier.
We're off for the holiday that we don't celebrate.
Yeah.
Let's be real.
Yeah, I never met a holiday I didn't like. Actually, but that's not true. We always miss doing the show. We only do it once. It's maybe the longest running talk show in radio history. But since we only do it once a week, when you know,
we gotta get it all in.
We don't get our fix.
Yeah.
John Miller, thank you.
Thank you, John Miller.
And,
happy Easter to you.
And we'll be back in a couple weeks.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with more Night Call. Right after this.
The domestic litigation firm of Cordell & Cordell is dedicated to leveling the playing field for men in divorce and now is offering complimentary 30-minute initial consultations. Men choose Cordell & Cordell because they want to feel that their interests and the interests of their children are aggressively championed. Everyone involved in a divorce is affected by the breakup of the family. Cordell & Cordell seeks to help you through this difficult time and to ensure your rights are protected so you can move on with your life. If you're a man confronted with a marriage you can't save, you should consider Cordell & Cordell, a partner men can count on. The attorneys at Cordell & Cordell work to help men maximize their role in their children's lives, which includes protecting men's financial means to do so. To schedule your complimentary 30-minute initial consultation, please call 313-465-1999. That's 313-465-1999. Or visit online at CordellCordell.com. That's CordellCordell.com. Offices in Ann Arbor, Novi, and Troy.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. Well, we're all pretty aware in this area. I know many of you are listening around the country and around the world, but Detroit in a financial crisis. I don't know. We'll find out whether we have to put that in quote marks or not. But most people believe that it is. There's a long-term debt that the city of Detroit is facing because of its obligations for union contracts and a number of other things relating to past employment patterns. There's also budgetary concerns that there's just not enough money coming in through the tax rolls to fund this city. It's considered a city in trouble to the point where the governor of Michigan, Rick Snyder, has appointed an emergency financial manager, Kevin Orr. And what a financial manager is going to do, in fact, maybe we could a lot easier turn this over to our guest, but I think most of you know that he's going to set things right. He's going to find out, like a family, if all of a sudden Dad, who used to have a $75,000 a year job and had a cottage at Higgins Lake and it has a motorcycle and stuff like that and given son an allowance, well, suddenly all that stuff's got to be sold off, all the extra stuff. The kid doesn't get an allowance anymore. It's pretty easy. You got to bring your budget in terms of your revenue, right? Right? And everybody's excited that Kevin Orr, forgetting about the fact that he's got tax liens on his house, but everybody's excited that maybe Kevin Orr, an emergency financial manager, can fix Detroit. Tom Stevens returns to the Peter Werby Show. Tom was last on our broadcast talking about the Detroit incinerator. He's been an attorney in Detroit for 27 years. He works with the National Lawyers Guild and a good friend of mine. Tom Stevens, welcome back to the show.
Hi, Peter. Happy to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, you probably, as I gave that introduction, probably had about 10 comments and 14 corrections. Am I correct in that?
I don't know. Where do you want me to start?
Well, know? Maybe outline it. I mean, the city is the city facing a financial crisis?
Is the city part of the planet Earth?
Well, we live in the richest country in the world. Why are so many school districts and cities in trouble? Why did the infrastructure just get a D plus? We went up a little from this national survey. The money's here. Why aren't we? Why do we have to put in an emergency financial manager?
Well, in brief, it's the consequence of being governed by financial thieves on Wall Street 10 years after you can start a war and get a million people killed based on lies and have no consequences whatsoever. We live in a society that is in crisis on almost every level, whether we talk about the economy, people's being able to, or I was going to say the environment, actually, or the economy, or people being able to handle their own environment and their own economy in their own house, as you said. And Detroit is like that, except more so.
Well, the narrative, I can't believe that I still hear this. Detroit was this wonderful city, which you could put in parentheses white, right? Up until Coleman Young. And then Coleman Young told white people to get out of Detroit, and then there was a succession of mismanagement and culminating in Kwame Kilpatrick. And these are the guys that are responsible.
Yeah, except if you read scholars like Tom Segrew and The Origins of the Urban Crisis in his more recent book, Sweet Land of Liberty, you find that that narrative is fundamentally false, of course, and very protective of those who want to maintain their power and their control over the way we live. And that's why we get to Kevin Orr and the financial emergency and Governor Snyder in Detroit.
Yeah, and Mayor Coleman Young never said that either. It was an ill-crafted sentence where he essentially told criminals to get out of town, to hit 8 Mile Road, which suburbanites said, well, he's telling all the criminals to come to our neighborhoods. So, but that's not what he meant. So, yeah, so we're talking about something structural where the deindustrialization began as early as the 1950s. But, you know, already we haven't even gotten to this and 5 minutes are gone. This is very complex what's going on. Does Detroit need an emergency financial manager?
Detroit needs to figure out a way to get ahead in the 21st century with the things that a community and a government and people need to do in an urban setting. An emergency financial manager is an official that goes back to the late 1980s under a state statute, a former state statute, who was put in place to deal with a community, I believe it was Ecorse, if memory serves, where the whole problem was caused by a local government that had stolen some money, not the kind of structural deindustrialization that you just outlined so well. And so The short answer is no. But the longer story is that Detroit's not only getting an emergency financial manager, Detroit's going to get what they now call an emergency manager. And in order to try to eliminate confusion, I just call them EMFs. Or since we're talking about the FCC here, EMS stands for Emergency Manager Fascist, and I won't use the other word that EMF stands for.
Okay.
But anyway, what one of these EMFs has power to do under Public Act 4, which you may remember was repealed by the voters last year,
Yeah. And
the forthcoming son of Public Act 4, what they call Public Act 436, which goes into effect on March 28th, is this kind of EMF takes all the power of the local government. He has the power of the legislature. He has the power of the executive. He has the power to make contracts, dispose of assets, break contracts. Extraordinary government power, which really, you know, what we're learning here is that history doesn't really proceed in a linear fashion like they thought in the 19th century. Remember Karl Marx said the proletariat was going to rise up and inevitably mm-hmm. bury the bourgeoisie, and they were going to be their own gravedigger. It sort of moves in circles, and what we're looking at instead now is a corporate feudalism kind of thing, where corporate capital and these guys on Wall Street are like the kings and princes of old, and we're their serfs. That's what's happening. And, you know, unsurprisingly, people are resisting.
Well, what about the idea that there's not enough money to fund even the basic services? Parks closed, schools closed, police are being laid off. Detroiters aren't paying their taxes, partly because they don't have the money to, and partly because they say, hey, I'm not paying taxes if I don't get any services. The money does not seem to be there to finance a modern city, even with a reduced population of 700,000 and some.
Well, when you say the money's not there, you know, you say a lot. Of course, we're in a worldwide food crisis right now where billions of people are food insecure, trying to live on $2 a day and the price of food going up by 10, 20, 30, 40% every year or something like that. So a financial crisis is, and not having enough money, as you say, is a very real thing for human beings. When you talk about an entity like a government that doesn't have enough money, or a corporation for that matter, what it means in reality, as they found out throughout what used to be called the Third World in the 1980s and 90s, is the banks won't loan you money. They've decided that you're no longer a good risk. And that's what we're really talking about. Detroit is a community that, as everybody knows, is plagued by all the ills of poverty. There's an extraordinarily high concentration of people who just can't get good jobs. You know, American working people haven't had a raise since the 1970s. And we have a situation where, like I said a little while ago, Detroit's like everywhere else except more so. So, yeah, the people of Detroit don't have enough money, and therefore the community of Detroit and the city of Detroit is effectively unsustainable. The question is whether this EMF, who comes in and restructures the budget and restructures the debt with Wall Street and so forth, is then going to generate all the amazing social and economic and political results that our corporate media is trumpeting already, since he hasn't even been on the job yet. He comes in next week. Or is he simply going to restructure the debt and balance the budget and leave the city in the same kind of condition it's in now? And what people who know about this have very cogently said is this EMF balance the budget business doesn't apply to a community that's in a structural decline and spiral like Detroit. It just doesn't work for the reason that I basically just outlined. He's defining the problem as if it's just balance the budget mm-hmm. and deal with Wall Street, make a deal with them, and so you can move forward on some kind of new corporate economic basis at the government level. That's not the problem, really, for the 700,000 or so of us that live in Detroit. The problem is we got a whole bunch of people that can't make a living, and people engaging in crime and all kinds of antisocial activities that are associated with poverty. And he doesn't have any qualifications.
This is Kevin Orr.
Yeah, Kevin Orr, to deal with anything like that. But, I mean, the thing is, it gets even worse because, you know, 2 days before Kevin Orr was officially, 3 days before, Kevin Orr was officially announced as the EFM under what they are pretending is the current law governing this. Dave Bing announced that he wanted to hire Kevin Orr's law firm, the Jones Day Law Firm, one of the largest law firms in the world, 2,400 lawyers, to be the city's restructuring council. So when you talk about a new form of governance here, I referenced, you know, corporate state feudalism a minute ago, you have to understand what this means. It's absolutely mind-boggling. the city of Detroit's government is going to be this one man, Kevin Orr, who, in order apparently to preserve some kind of appearances, recently quit his job as a partner in this giant law firm, which is going to be charged with doing this restructuring business.
Tom Stevens is my guest. He works with the National Lawyers Guild and defines himself as a Detroit people's lawyer. Well, here is what is always curious to me. What you defined essentially is a position, the emergency financial manager, that doesn't have any resemblance to a democratic process, but rather is a dictator. How can you're an attorney? I thought like contracts were sacrosanct. You couldn't break contracts except under the most egregious circumstances. How can an emergency financial manager under a Michigan state law? Let's go all the way back. How can the governor just say pronounce you? I know there's a commission that looks at that and all that, but it's okay, you're in crisis. I'm appointing a manager. The manager then sells off assets, like was done in Pontiac's, breaks contracts with unions, privatizes services. Where does this authority come from?
Well, that's an excellent question. And if you look carefully at the training materials that the Snyder administration put together for their squadrons or cadres of EMFs that they trained early in the administration when they were passing the Public Act 4, their original emergency manager legislation, they are very careful to say that that is an issue and that you have to be very careful about voiding contracts. That's in a very involved legal conversation that we really don't have time to get through completely, but it involves weighing the public interest against the degree of impairment of the contract. The Constitution of both the state of Michigan and the United States prohibits impairment of the obligation of contract. What that means in a situation like this, and where bankruptcy, which is what this guy's and half of his or a large part of his firm specializes in, becomes a question.
Well, and I'm surprised that in the past there has there been any legal action on the part of people that have come out on the wrong end of restructuring or privatization or broken union contracts. Has there been challenges?
There have been some. For the most part, the courts did not deal with the broader issues last year, I think because the referendum was pending. Why issue a ruling on these complex issues, even though the governor specifically asked the state Supreme Court to take it on an urgent basis, when you have these referendums pending and the voters might strike it down anyway, which is what eventually happened? There was a case in Pontiac in which a clerk was fired by the former emergency financial manager of Pontiac and was able to maintain her case in court under the Civil Rights Act, although the claim was in defense that, well, I'm an emergency manager, I don't have to obey that. So there is a little bit of precedent, but you have to understand this form of government is absolutely unprecedented in American history. For them to the emergency financial manager under the old law had the power to come in and set the budget. The emergency manager under what they're doing now has all government power of the municipality, subject only to the supervision of the state treasurer and the state governor. By law, it says in the statute, at the state treasurer's sole discretion, uncontrolled by anything. So this is a huge experiment.
You mentioned earlier, and I just want to revisit this a little, Kevin Orr, who was the appointed emergency financial manager, had worked for the law firm Jones Day, and his work there was as a restructuring partner, and now the city of Detroit has hired Jones Day to also represent it as its restructuring counsel. Kevin Orr has resigned. Is there anything inherently wrong with that? I mean, it would seem if you were going to have an emergency financial manager and a restructuring firm, it would seem that they would have a symbiosis that would be beneficial.
I think that's the position they're going to take, but and that's in fact that's what Kevin Orr said. He said, when I serve as bankruptcy trustee, I hire my firm all the time. The difference is that the bankruptcy trustee and the firm that's representing the debtor are subject to who? A bankruptcy judge. And there has to be full disclosure of all conflicts. Who are they disclosing the conflicts to here, and who's supervising them?
Mm-hmm.
They're executing Governor Snyder and Treasurer Dillon's will. And as far as conflicts goes, there's been no disclosure at all. They've simply said, I quit my job, and therefore it's no problem. In fact, Jones Day represents Bank of America, among many other giant corporate and banking clients. Bank of America owns Merrill Lynch. Remember Merrill Lynch used to be bullish on America, used to be an investment bank, went bankrupt in the crash and got bought by Bank of America. And Merrill Lynch is what's called a counterparty on interest rate swaps that the city of Detroit is in the process of negotiating right now.
You know, it's a little difficult to understand. One of the things that I've said to people, like I remember when this crash came in 2007, and I said, well, listen, I'm on the air. I better be really familiar with all these, what they call exotic instruments, these exotic financial instruments. And I don't know whether it's laziness or what, but I really came to the conclusion, if there's financial stuff going on and the average person can't understand it, there's something inherently wrong. Or is that just a cop-out for me not being able to understand all this financial stuff? Like you were talking interest rate swaps. I mean, I'm not even asking you to explain it, but the fact that that I suspect along, you know, it nothing arose. In other words, I think it gets back to what you were talking about, the financial interests, who you've often referred to as the banksters, who have pretty much us by the throat.
You're certainly not capping out there, but I think you're in terms of what we're talking about right now, you're certainly not taking the next step, which is the critical point, which is that not only are they doing stuff that just doesn't make sense, that's basically a flim-flam, Ponzi, con artist game, they're now taking the position of government and saying, we're going to make the rules from now on, make the decisions about who gets what, who we're going to be the ones who makes the decision, and don't even talk about who pays and who benefits from it. That's the new form of government, apparently.
Who is going to benefit from it? The idea is that eventually, at the end of this, the city of Detroit will, because there'll be a balanced budget and somehow they'll deal with the long-term obligations. Is there anybody who stands to make a ton of money off of this?
I think that every single one of those counterparties on the swaps stands to and will make a ton of money off it. I think that the billions of dollars of contracts and services that are provided by, for example, the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department. I think that what this is all about is privatization on mega steroids, if you will. I mean, there's been, and, you know, Mayor Bing has been trying to do this for 3 years. It's just that he doesn't have the ability to be a mayor of a big city. He talks and announces things, and then they turn out to be, well, there's no there. That's where Kevin Orr is coming in. So, yeah, there's a ton of money to be made. I mean, you know, what is the city of Detroit? I mean, it's a government on one level. You know, we talk about Detroit as the auto manufacturers. If you look down at Detroit from, you know, 20,000 feet or whatever, there's 139 square miles. It's urban real estate. In terms of the economy and prices and so forth, it's vastly underutilized and therefore cheap. It's on the busiest international border in North America. It's in the heart of the most precious freshwater resources in the world, which in today's world is of incredible value. So, you know, what you have here is, without making any kind of allegation of any kind of conspiracy, these people don't need to conspire. They make the laws. What you have here is a policy of turning all that value over, all that potential and actual value, and the rights of the people that live in that space over to Kevin Orr, his law firm, and his clients. Is there anything wrong with that? You tell me, Peter.
Well, for sure. Well, let's look at the political implications of this. It's often been said that that it works in two ways. That privatization turns it over to people that want to see the extension of corporate power, often led by the Republicans, but Democrats do all right as well. Jennifer Granholm, the governor before the current one, certainly set in motion any number of emergency financial managers, but that it also, that it works for Republican Party interests because it destroys the unions that are the basis financially and staffing of the Democratic Party electoral efforts. Is any of this in play there? And particularly against the fact that Governor Granholm was one of the ones who were setting this forth.
Yes, all of it, and this is thoroughly bipartisan, but I would broaden the frame considerably. I mean, that's what this is all about, is broadening the frame, really. That's, you know, that's really what would be my main message, is look at what's going on. I mean, we've heard most recently about this thing in Canada with Indigenous people, Idle No More. Before that, there was Occupy. There's people rising up throughout Greece, Syntagma Square in Athens and all over the country, Plaza del Sol, and throughout Spain, throughout all the indigenous
Nicosia
countries.
Nicosia today and yesterday, yeah, in Cyprus.
We've heard about Tahrir Square. Right now, Cyprus is the hot spot, and the next hot spot, I think, is going to be Detroit. Because, you know, what we need to see is that there's working people all over the country, all over the world, who need to have a certain relationship to, like you said, you know, where's the money? Is there enough money? Mm-hmm. We need to have a certain relationship to our society and to our economy in order to keep a roof over our heads, feed ourselves, educate our children, et cetera, meet all the necessities. And that whole relationship for all of us is in crisis right now. And we're all facing the same struggle and the same issue. And Kevin Orr and Jones Day Law Firm and Governor Snyder and Andy Dillon are agents of what the Occupy Wall Street people so brilliantly call the 1%. That's what's going on. And Detroit is about to step forward, I think, into the front rank of all these struggles. And you're going to see in the streets, and I think you're going to see in the courts. I think you're going to see in City Hall, downtown, and all over this region, well, these debates playing themselves out.
The Occupy movement was interesting because it was the first one in a long time that actually looked at the entire system. Most of the other things that you mentioned as admirable and as courageous oftentimes as they were either resistance against dictatorships or reacting to specific economic crimes. But what do we do? Do we have a movement saying we want more responsibility and interest rate swaps? I mean, that's not going to bring people out. In other words, there's got to be something, a dramatic presentation of issues and of a vision and a solution outside of what you're being critical of.
Absolutely. I mean, you know, where do you want me to start? The most recent example that comes to my mind is the incredible speech that the president of Bolivia, Evo Morales, gave on December 21st, 2012, you know, the day that was supposed to be the end of the earth, according to Nostradamus or whoever. You know, we need to make peace with the planet Earth. We need to reinvent democracy, reinvent whatever you want to call it, capitalism or the economy. And we need basically a whole new deal about how we're going to get through the comprehensive crisis that we face. You know, there's this great journalism professor down in Austin, Texas, the University of Texas, Robert Jensen, who talks about a rational apocalypticism, you know.
Wow.
That the word apocalypse and the word revelation are about lifting the veil. Well, you know, if you step back and you learn and you pay attention and listen to what's happening, you know, to the poorest of the poor in Detroit or in Chiapas, or in Egypt or wherever, you know, it sort of lifts the veil as to what's really happening in our world. And what I'm saying is, in a nutshell, we need to deal with that instead of this business that Kevin Orr and Governor Snyder are talking about restructuring the debt and balancing the budget. You know, Detroit used to have a mayor named Frank Murphy in the Depression, and he was one of the most distinguished Detroiters in all of history. He went on to be Governor General of the Philippines, Attorney General of the United States, and a Supreme Court Justice. In the 1930s, in the heart of that Depression, he said, To look at balancing the budget to the exclusion of all other issues is fanaticism. And that's what we're dealing with from Governor Snyder right now. He's, you know, he talks like he just fell out of off the turnip truck. The guy's so slick. But this is fanaticism. This is the Koch brothers' agenda pushed to the nth degree as far as he can. And of course people are going to fight back against it. Give me a break.
Tom Stevens, just have 60 seconds left, and maybe this is too much to ask, but where can people hook into their concerns about this? I mean, remember, there's certainly people, Detroiters, but there's also the concern for the metro area as well. Maybe those formations aren't in place yet, but is there any place people can go tomorrow?
There's so many places, you know, that's the thing. It would be good to unite as much as possible. There's a new website called Open Detroit that's dealing with these issues. You know, the Cass Corridor Commons at the corner of Forest and Cass in Detroit. There's people working on this stuff. Central Methodist Church on Woodward and just about a block north of Grand Circus Park. Well, no, it's right across from Grand Circus Park is another place. Basically, all of Detroit is in the process of rising up against this to the point we can, and you're going to see it.
Well, we shall see, and I hope we see. Tom Stevens, thanks for putting this all in perspective. Tom Stevens works with the National Lawyers Guild. I think it's NLG.org. That's the national organization. And he is working here in Detroit to make some sense out of what we're facing. Tom, thanks for being on the Peter Werby Show.
Pleasure to be here. Thanks for having me.
This is Night Call on 101 WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
If you're like me, you probably had to do something hard today. I mean, personally, I hate washing out socks. That's why we made Geico.com so exceedingly easy. Easy to see how much you could save on car insurance. Easy to review and update your policy. Change of address. Just a few clicks and you're done. Visit Geico.com today because life is hard enough. I mean, I don't even wear socks.
Dirty little secret. Dirty little lies. Say your prayers and comb your hair. Save your soul tonight.
Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. Peter Werby here with you. This is an auspicious, an inauspicious, or which is it? It's an anniversary of a war, something that none of us like to face. Another one of these wars gone bad, as they have in the last 30, 40 years with the United States. Yet they keep on coming, don't they? There's been a lot of reflection on it, probably not enough. And the real question is, has this country learned anything? You, listeners, next time you see these bulletins and suddenly all the cables and the news channels start bringing out the guys in suits pointing at maps and looking, the reason the president gets on the air and says the reason why we have to invade Venezuela. You're going to swallow it all again, hook, line, and sinker, like so many people did? Not all of you, I know. Not a lot of people that listen to this broadcast. And one of the reasons that many of you probably realize that the rationale for the war in Iraq, now the 10th anniversary of the beginning of it this week, is because you listen to this broadcast. And I'm not blowing my own horn here. The reason I knew that there was no weapons of mass destruction, the reason I knew that there was no reason to invade Iraq, was because of the many of the guests that I had on this program. And they came very frequently from the Institute for Public Accuracy. They never get credit on this because, you know, I say it's so-and-so, not the group that has provided the guests for me. The Institute for Public Accuracy at accuracy.org provides guests on any range of subjects, but they were incredibly crucial 10 years ago that allowed so many people in this country, unfortunately not enough, and not enough that they were listening to by the politicians who repeated the lies of the Bush administration. But we're fortunate to have with us the communications director for the Institute for Public Accuracy. He's Sam Husseini, and he's often who I speak to when we set up interviews. And we're reaching him at his office in Washington, D.C. Sam Husseini, welcome to the Peter Werbe Show, sort of coming out from the shadows, huh?
Good to be with you, Peter. Thank you.
Yeah. And you and Norman Solomon, who also works with the Institute for Public Accuracy, who I've had on this program any number of times, mm-hmm. are available for interviews about the legacy of Iraq war myths 10 years later. Are there still myths? I would almost think that they've all been shattered.
No, I don't think they have. I think that there are still a lot of myths. I mean, and they're, you know, like with any myth, there's a grain of truth to them. So there's a myth with a grain of truth that George Bush and Dick Cheney took the country to war and fooled everybody, and a disaster ensued. But I think there are some problems with that, and I think that that, in a sense, is a myth, because they had a lot of help, including a lot of people who are in the current administration. Joe Biden, the vice president, was head of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee at the time. He oversaw hearings that we critiqued at the time in 2002 during the buildup to the Iraq invasion. Citing Scott Ritter, who was a former weapons inspector, saying that they were a sham hearing, that Biden had in effect stacked the deck and oversaw hearings that were skewing the information and polluting the public discourse and not really offering a meaningful critique at all of the propaganda and the lies being led by the Bush administration. And he voted for the war, as did John Kerry, the current Secretary of State, as did Chuck Hagel, the current Secretary of Defense, so-called.
And so did Hillary Clinton, right?
As did Hillary Clinton.
Yeah.
And, of course, you know, Obama's first Secretary of Defense was Gates, who came out of the Bush administration. So basically the entire foreign policy team of the Obama administration propagated lies about Iraqi weapons of mass destruction, which, and I'll say another myth.
Well, before you do that,
yeah.
let me just say, but Sam Husseini, you and me and any number of people listening to this program and millions of people throughout the United States and around the world knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction.
And that's exactly what I was hitting on. The weapons of mass destruction that we now know weren't there, that the you know, Hagel and Kerry, along with Bush and Cheney and company, said that there were these weapons of mass destruction.
But don't you think they knew there were none? Isn't it the worst political cynicism on their part?
Right. What I can say is this. We knew that they were lying at the time. I think that it is it is provable that they were lying at the time. For example, the Bush administration would misrepresent what the weapons inspectors were saying. You know, there were weapons, there were UN weapons inspectors at the, on the ground in Iraq, and Iraq was disclosing information to them, and the weapons inspectors were saying things like, well, we're getting a ton of information from Iraq, and this is very helpful, and we want to continue doing our work. And 2 days later, the Bush administration would say, would say the weapons inspectors aren't being granted full access by the Iraqi regime. Total lie.
Yeah.
They would claim that studies existed from the International Atomic Energy Agency that didn't exist, and so on. So you knew that there was a pattern of deceit. That's actually a title of a news release that we put out just before the war. You know, we sort of strung a bunch of things together, pointing out the fabrications and the lies. And, you know, even people who voted against the war facilitated it.
Like Nancy Pelosi and Barack Obama?
Right. Nancy Pelosi said that there's no question that Saddam Hussein has chemical and biological weapons. And then, you know, quibbled about whether or not he had a nuclear program. So that she sort of gave away the store, you know. So she, in effect, paved the way for war in the rhetoric that she used while nominally voting against it. And Barack Obama, you know, he wasn't in the public limelight at the time, of course. He was a state senator in Illinois. He did give one speech, brief speech at a demonstration against the war. But people might recall that after the invasion, for several months, it looked like a quote-unquote success before the resistance had materialized. People were, you know, slamming the naysayers and the doubters, and will the anti-war crowd ever show themselves in public again, and all of this. Obama at that point was quoted in the New York Times as saying, "I'm not sure how I would have voted." That is, you know, I was inclined against the war, but he didn't have to vote, unlike Pelosi and Clinton and Kerry and Hagel and company. So, you know, that was sort of odd. And you know, it's particularly odd because, I mean, I think a lot of people got behind Obama in 2008 because he did give that one anti-war speech, that he was, quote unquote, anti-war, and pushed aside all of the candidates who had voted for the war. But then you still ended up getting a pro-war cabinet, which I think is, you know, sort of the part of the origins of the continuity that we've seen between the Bush administration foreign policy and the Obama foreign policy.
Well, do you think that, in other words, these politicians that must have known there were no weapons of mass destruction, Saddam Hussein, if you and I knew, they certainly knew. So
yeah.
That they were just stampeded out of fear that that further aspirations that almost each one of them had, I'm talking about the Democratic Party politicians, that they to oppose this, given the full court press that the Bush Cheney administration was carrying on, that they could not do that and look patriotic. In other words, they couldn't line up with the quote anti-war crowd.
They couldn't line up with the anti-war crowd, and you know, I mean, I think a lot of these people have their own value system, their own belief system, and their own belief system says that it's okay to put out disinformation, or at the very minimum, dubious information, in order to pave the way for an illegal invasion. That's, you know, I mean, part of it might be political fear, but part of it is their own innate belief system, which is highly unethical.
Well, part of the belief system, of course, is that the United States has the right to go anywhere at any time, do anything at its own choosing. That's one of the things that's continually affirmed. I mean, one of the things I often say, for instance, were the war games that the Institute for Public Accuracy had offered guests about, mentioned the war games that the United States and South Korea were carrying out near North Korea. And, gee, don't you think that's going to make them a little nervous? And I would say it would be like if China and Mexico were deciding to hold war games off the coast of California and New York. So we can do that. We can go to our take care of quote our quote interests in the Middle East or Asia or South America or wherever, but no one else can. I mean, it's sort of an expanded Monroe Doctrine, if you will, worldwide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. No, I think that is true, and the U.S. has acted that way. It's acting that way in the drone policy in terms of assassination, and it's acting that way on a larger scale in terms of threats of war. You know, we get to say to Iran, or our leaders do, all options are on the table, a tacit threat of war. You know, imagine some other country saying that to the U.S.
Sure.
Which sort of North Korea does. I mean, North Korea gives a whole list of grievances and then, you know, talks about, you know, preemptively attacking the U.S. and South Korea because they're doing these war games and doing all these other things to North Korea. And then that all of the reasons that they have, some of which are legitimate, get totally pushed to the side. Don't get reported. And, you know, North Korea ends up looking like a, you know, total 100% nutball when there are legitimate grievances that they have there. And it's not quite a grievance, but part of the dynamic here is that North Korea has sort of taken the lesson of Iraq. I mean, what happened to Iraq? They disarmed and they got invaded.
Sure.
Gaddafi disarmed. He got rid of all his WMDs and we did a bombing campaign and all kinds of other things, and he got ousted in the crudest possible fashion. You know, the logical conclusion from that is don't disarm.
Yeah, if you do have nuclear weapons, you're safeguarded. Sam Husseini is my guest. He's the communications director for the Institute for Public Accuracy. And the Institute for Public Accuracy provides a lot of guests for me on this show. This is the Peter Werbe show. You read now, in fact, even this week, editorials in the New York Times that I'm always quoting from articles on my shows. They talk about how this war was based. They even use the L word now, lies. The war was based on the lies of the Bush-Cheney administration, and we know now that there were no weapons of mass destruction. And you get a lot of critics wanting to put this all off on Bush-Cheney, but there's a large complicity among the major institutions of this country, including the media. I wonder, Sam, if you could talk about that a little.
Absolutely. I mean, I think the media were critical. You couldn't – it was almost impossible to make the case to say, hold on a minute, where's the evidence here in much of the media? I mean, there were like a handful of exceptions. Knight Ritter did some good reporting at the time.
McClatchy did.
They've merged with McClatchy now.
Okay.
So, you know, I mean, they're you know, sort of, they went belly up and now they're basically McClatchy. One AP reporter, Henry did some good work. It's, you know, an absolute handful of people in the mainstream who bucked the mantra and the drums for war.
But the Times was almost the most egregious, wasn't it?
It was. It was almost working hand in glove with the Bush administration at times. The Bush administration would leak a story, a fabricated story, to the New York Times. It would be on the front page of the New York Times, and then Dick Cheney would appear on Meet the Press the same day and cite the story as evidence that Iraq has WMDs and isn't coming clean. Judy Miller at the Times was the most egregious, and she paid somewhat of a price in her career. But by and large, the people who went along with this and the people who propagandized around this all went along and defended. And they're basically in charge, you know, of most of the media. And virtually everybody who really scrutinized things ended up losing out. Bob Scheer of the L.A. Times, he had a column there. he got ousted. He lost his column, even though he was one of the few columnists who was raising questions during the build-up to the war. It was just a drumbeat that conflated Iraq with al-Qaeda and just, you know, mocked virtually the notion that Iraq didn't have weapons of mass destruction. I think the media were a crucial part of it, and they dovetail with the Democrats in a lot of ways. And I mean, nobody's genuinely come clean. I've questioned these people. I've questioned Kerry. I've questioned Hagel. Kerry claimed to me that as soon as Bush, he was claiming that the Iraq war vote was not really a war vote. And that as soon as Bush actually went to war based on that vote, I objected. And I was like, sir. So I went back and checked, and he didn't object. Kerry at the time in 2003 was saying, we can't cut and run after the war. That was his line. And almost, you know, outflanking the Bush administration from the right. And a lot of the media did this too, saying you can't cut and run. So, I mean, if they were genuinely, saying that, you know, Bush has violated the Constitution, he didn't really get proper authorization, they would have made us think about it at the time. Nothing like that happened.
Sure. Imagine foreign policy, specifically about war, based on little slogans like don't cut or run. You know, in, pardon me, at counterpunch.org today, pardon me again, there is, Ralph Nader has written a piece called The Socio Side of Iraq by Bush Cheney. In other words, essentially meaning the destruction of that society. I wonder if you could roll that, or if I could roll that into a question about what the overall effect has been and whether this was a win or a loss or a draw for the United States.
Yeah, well, I mean, what happened to Iraq, even what's continuing to happen with Iraq, I mean, you have this massive sectarian war that happened, and it's, you know, all too easy to say, oh, well, that was, you know, the Iraqis' fault and so on. But if you really look at the specifics, you had U.S. apparatchiks on the ground in Iraq who had a history in Latin American, Central American wars, arming various factions, militarizing the conflict, and sowing the seeds for the sectarian war that we've seen.
This would be like James Steele?
Exactly.
Yeah, maybe just quickly.
The Guardian piece.
Yeah, I'm sorry, I talked over you, so mention that again.
The Guardian had a very strong little documentary that they did on James Steele, who has a history as the military apparatchik in Latin America, and they brought him in at the beginning of right after the Iraq invasion, and he backed and armed various militias that ended up, you know, the Shiite militias killing Sunnis and so on. And then a couple of years later, they did the exact opposite, funding and arming Sunni militias. So you end up with, quite predictably, I think, with the sectarian warfare. And Iraq was a secular country. Saddam Hussein was a tyrannical dictator, but it was fundamentally a secular country.
Which is why Osama bin Laden hated him.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. I mean, it was such an insane response to say, oh, we're getting attacked by these Islamists, jihadists, we're going to go after the most secular country in the Middle East. You know, the whole thing never added up from the get-go.
You know, we have so, when we talk about 25 minutes, seems like a lot of time to talk. We only have about 5 minutes left with Sam Husseini, who's the communications director for the Institute for Public Accuracy. You can go to accuracy.org and see the list of great guests, many of which have been on this program as well. When we started hearing about the toll, it's funny, it doesn't really raise anybody's temperature at all, the fact that at least 4,500 Americans were killed, at a minimum 30,000 wounded, and a lot of people say that the The grievous wounded really is probably have to put another 100,000 on that. But there's always a debate about what happened to the Iraqi people. Are there any statistics, killed, wounded, home, made refugees that you feel comfortable stating?
Yeah, well, I mean, the bottom, you know, at the bottom of the figures is with the Iraq body count, which actually, you know, lists names and dates and so on of people killed, and that's a little under 200,000 people. The higher range estimate is about 1.5 million, and that's an estimate that's largely based around the Lancet, a prestigious medical journal. A group from Johns Hopkins basically went door to door with different population samples and then estimated based on that how many people were actually killed. So,
you know, that's interesting. Let me just interrupt you 1 second. When the estimates, we always know in the most strict detail of the U.S. casualties, but when the United States goes to Indochina, then there's an estimate between 2 and 3 million. Imagine there that your family or your loved one or your son or daughter or something like that was in the estimate that there were so many people killed in these wars based on lies that it's just like disposable estimates. Yeah.
Right. Yeah, yeah, no, you're very true. I mean,
have
we
learned
any? We get so hung up on numbers, you know.
Have we learned anything? I mean, now we're not going in. We're just going to get everybody with drones. Why send troops in when we can just use the drones?
Right, the bravery of being out of range.
And they'll get medals now. They've developed new medals. for the drone operator. So they're in Colorado Springs or someplace like that. They take out some family's home that may or may not have had the target, and then they go to happy hour at 4 o'clock.
Nintendo Wii kind of thing. I'd like to share one sort of hopeful story, and that's something that people don't know about, even, you know, political types who follow this stuff, and that's the story of Catherine Gunn. She was a translator in the British Secret Service, and right before there was supposed to be a second resolution at the UN after Colin Powell spoke there. People might remember Colin Powell's speech. It was full of disinformation and lauded at the time. And the U.S. put out a memo to the British Secret Service saying, let's have a surge of activity spying on U.N. missions so that we can get more leverage to get these U.N. missions to vote with us in the Security Council. Basically, let's dig up dirt on the diplomats in the U.N., so that we can strong arm them into voting our way on this Iraq war resolution. And she leaked that memo, and it barely got any coverage in the United States. Dan Ellsberg, who leaked the Pentagon Papers, has said this is the most significant leak of all time, even though it's very short, much shorter than, you know, WikiLeaks puts out tons of information, short memo. And it basically stopped the UN from approving the second resolution. It got tremendous play in the countries that, you know, were in the Security Council, Chile, Mexico, I think Nigeria, you know, the other countries in the Security Council. So that was, you know, one thing that, you know, where one person literally, you know, tried to put the brakes on things.
And people also, I mean, like my wife and I and friends, we were in a demonstration in February of 2003 in New York City where 1 million people said no to the war, but it barely got a blip on the national news. Unfortunately, we're out of time. Just the summaries of the guests that are available through the Institute for Public Accuracy, of which my guest, Sam Husseini, is the communications director for, are pretty telling, and I would urge you to go to accuracy.org. On my website, peterwerby.com, there's a lot of stuff about the 10th anniversary, and including the story of Thomas Young, a dying Iraq war vet who penned this last letter to Bush and Cheney, accusing them very directly and very strongly of war crimes. Sam Husseini, thanks for all the good work you do. I actually probably couldn't do as good a show as I do without the help of the Institute for Public Accuracy, and thanks for adding to this dialogue that we all need to hear.
You're very welcome. Thank you, Peter.
Thank you for listening to Night Call on 101 WRIF. The views expressed on the program are not necessarily those of the staff, management, or ownership of WRIF Radio. Now, stay tuned for more Riff Rock on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Clipping coupons. Standing in line at 4 a.m. Buying five to get one free. Maybe it's me, but I don't think it should be that hard to save money, which is why we made Geico.com so easy. Just a few clicks and you could be saving hundreds of dollars on your car insurance. And when you switch to Geico, you can do practically everything online. Report a claim, update your policy, even pay your bill. Click, bam, boom. Visit Geico.com today. Click, bam, boom. I'm rather fond of that one.
Search is underway. Ladies, get more details or apply online now at WRIF.com. Bow down.
You're going to get what you deserve. Bow down before the one you serve. You're going to get what you deserve.